Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hello, Neo.
Who are you?
I am the architect.
Let's start, though, with a story about a profession that has not done a good job when it comes to inclusion. Now, not Hollywood directors or CEO of Fortune 500 companies. We're talking about architects. The profession is overwhelmingly white, but there is an effort to change that. Architects throughout the country are working to encourage more young people of color to join the profession. And as we speak, a bunch of them are meeting right here in L.A. to figure out ways to do that. Take Two's Julian Burrell has this story about adding more color to the business of design.
After 13 years of hard work, Jason Morris is finally a licensed architect.
It's a long journey, but nothing that's worth doing is easy.
Morris works with the building design firm Gruen Associates, and he's a member of a pretty exclusive group. He's not just an architect, he's a black architect. And he was the only one in his graduating class.
It definitely stands out in your mind when you're there, and you're like, oh, okay, all right, I'm the only one, you know.
According to NOMA, the National Organization of Minority Architects, of the more than 100,000 licensed architects in the country, only 2% of them are black. And all other racial minorities, they're faring pretty similarly. The lack of diversity in the profession is especially odd in a place like Southern California. We've got some of the most varied building design of anywhere else in the country. Modern minimalist studio apartments, Spanish-style homes, 40s-style concert halls, and all sometimes within the same neighborhood.
Southern California really is the nexus of all great design. I mean, here we are with Hollywood and fashion and movies and architecture. It's all really happening here in Los Angeles.
Mike Enomoto is a managing partner at Gruen. He says the rich mix of architecture in L.A. wasn't the result of having a rich mix of architects.
For many, many years, a long time ago, I think the profession was dominated by white America and upper-class white America, for that matter.
Enomoto believes a key to inspiring the next generation of minority architects is to let them know about the previous generation's contributions to the local landscape. His colleague, Deborah Gerard, had an idea that could help with that. They were at the National Conference of the American Institute of Architects in Philadelphia.
There was this map in Philadelphia of all the, you know, important buildings in Philadelphia and the architects' names, and I thought, man, what a great idea. We could do that and pick out all the buildings that were designed by African-American architects.
Jason Morris jumped at the chance to help put that map together. It features over 50 local buildings, including one pretty familiar to many Angelenos.
We're at the Pacific Design Center. Norma Sklarik, a black woman architect, was kind of working behind the scenes on a lot of the production work and the architecture side of things in the office.
The massive structure is a landmark in West Hollywood. The geometry and colors make it look like a toy set.
It almost feels like you're a tiny little Lego standing among these gigantic Legos.
There are three giant Legos, red, green, and blue. Architect Norma Sklarik worked on the blue part, which has been nicknamed the Blue Whale.
You could see this long facade, very flat with a few undulations around the top. It's quite opaque in the front, but the part that kind of makes it the blue whale is the fact that the bottom part is actually transparent, and the top blue portion is actually, you know, opaque. So it's got this big, giant mass sitting, kind of floating off of the street.
Norma Skalarik was the first African-American woman to be licensed as an architect. She worked on other major projects throughout her career, including Terminal 1 at LAX and the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, Japan. But like many of her contemporaries, her work wasn't widely publicized. That's because unless you're the chief architect of a building, your contributions to the craft are hidden. Jason Morris thinks that should change. He's all for giving credit to the full team of designers who contribute to buildings.
That could also be another step toward increasing awareness.
The AIA largely agrees. This year, they've scheduled conferences, speaking engagements, and meetings, all designed to find out what can be done to get people of color interested in the profession. Morris looks forward to doing his part.
I just want to be visible, you know, so it's going to be really important to do the career fairs, go to the schools, talk to the students, you know, be involved with mentorship programs where I and other black architects can interact with other people of color and essentially provide an example for what they can be.
But here's a question. How important is diversity to a profession like architecture? After all, isn't a good building just a good building? Deborah Gerard certainly thinks so.
As you walk down the street, do you have any clue who designed each building and what their makeup was? Are they female? Are they male? What's their ethnicity? I'm going to guess that that's not that easy to pick out, but I think it's not really the point either.
Neither does Enomoto. He says it's really about allowing people to shape the places where they live.
I'm not necessarily looking for homogeneous type designs throughout any particular community. However, at some point, you have to take a step back and look at whether or not the issue of diversity is being addressed by the profession.
And as one of the newest architects on the block, Jason Morris is doing what he can to help turn things around.
I've been working towards trying to improve the numbers of black people in the profession, so it's kind of cool to see, you know, one. It's kind of awesome.
And today, the AIA is holding something called Encompass, the Conference to Actualize Diversity and Inclusion. It's going on all day at the California African American Museum. For Take Two, I'm Julian Burrell.
I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
We close today's show with a look at the battle between residents of eastern North Carolina and one of the state's largest industries, hog farms. Last week, the North Carolina lawmakers passed House Bill 467, which limits the damages that residents can collect against hog farms. The billion-dollar industry is primarily clustered in the eastern part of North Carolina, where hog farms collect billions of gallons of untreated pig feces and urine in what are essentially cesspools, then dispose of the waste by spraying it into the air. In an investigation into the industry, filmmaker Mark DeVries used drones to capture aerial footage of several massive facilities that supply pigs for Smithfield Foods. He spoke with Steve Wing, associate professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina's Giddings School of Public Health, who described what happens in the facilities.
The waste falls through the floors. It's flushed out into an open pit. Like a cesspool. It's easy for a big hog operation to have as much waste as a medium-sized city. Of course, the pit will fill up, so it has to be emptied, and they're emptied by spraying the liquid waste.
Yes, you heard that right.
If you're familiar with a garden sprayer, there are gigantic versions of that. So they're making droplets, fine mists, out of this liquid waste. And that can drift downwind into the neighboring communities.
Residents living in the area of the spray complain of odors so bad it limits their ability to be outdoors and adverse health effects. House Bill 467, or the Agriculture and Forestry Nuisance Remedies Bill, was introduced by Republican State Representative Jimmy Dixon, a longtime farmer who's received campaign contributions from the hog industry. Speaking at a hearing about the legislation, Dixon said, quote, "These claims are at best enormous exaggerations and at worst outright lies. Is there some odor? Yes. But I would like you to close your eyes and imagine how ham and sausage and eggs and fried chicken smell," he said. The legislation comes as a class action suit brought by nearly 500 primarily African-American residents of eastern North Carolina seek financial compensation from Murphy Brown, the state's largest hog producer. The lawsuits have now moved to federal court. Well, for more, we're joined by Naima Muhammad, organizing co-director for the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network. And we're joined by Will Hendricks, staff attorney with the Waterkeeper Alliance and manager of the organization's North Carolina Pure Farms, Pure Waters campaign. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Naima. Can you tell us where you live and what you're dealing with today?
Yes, okay. I live in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, which is in the eastern part of the state, but I am in the northeastern part of the state. I live away from where these animals are, but I work with communities that's living with these animals, and I've been working with these communities since 1999. And so I'm constantly going into the communities where these animals are, and, you know, and I smell what the people living there are smelling. I see the spraying going on. I see the hog houses and the open-air lagoons that's just sitting out there. As you travel through those communities, you can't help but see these houses that the animals are kept in, as well as the lagoons and the spray fields.
So I want to turn to another clip from Mark DeVries' video. Here he speaks with Elsie Herring, a resident of Wallace, North Carolina. She's part of the complaint filed with the EPA seeking more protections for neighbors of hog farm operations.
This is where they spray animal waste on us. This is about 8 feet from my mother's house.
What is it like when the mist is...
It's like, you think it's raining?
Really?
You think it's raining. We don't open the doors or the windows, but the odor still comes in. It takes your breath away. Then you start gagging. You get headaches.
And I want to turn to former pig factory farm owner Don Webb.
I shut my hog operation down, and I got out of it. And I just couldn't do another person that way to make them smell that. It is a cesspool that you put feces and urine in, a hole in the ground that you dump a toxic waste in. And I've seen dead hogs in them and stuff like that. I've seen it. I've talked to the people. I've seen the little children that say, Mom and Daddy, why we got to smell this stuff? You get stories like, I can't hang my clothes out. Feces and urine odor comes by and attaches itself to your clothes. And then people will say, we're scared to invite neighbors.
So that's former pig factory farmer Don Webb, who closed his farm. Naima, explain exactly what is in the spray that people are inhaling and getting on their clothes, the residents in East North Carolina.
Okay, so the spray is the animal waste that comes out of the hogs are kept in tent metal housing. And they have slacks in the floor where whenever they go to the bathroom or abort baby piglets or whatever happens with them, it falls through the slacks in the floor and it's piped out. There are pipes running underneath the ground and the waste is piped out into the open air lagoon. And there are all kinds of chemicals. This urine and fecus. Fecal matter produces methane, ammonia gases, and so you can smell it. And what people say, it smells like rotten eggs, sometimes rotten collard greens, or it's just a terrible smell. And they have been forced off of their wells because they were seeing remnants of the waste in their well waters by the coloring and the odors coming out of their well water.
So, Will Hendrick, you're an attorney with Waterkeeper Alliance. Can you describe how extensive this is, how many people are affected, and what the State Carolina Legislature House Bill 467 is all about?
Certainly. This bill is an attempt to protect polluters over people, to deny rights to the victims of nuisance caused by agricultural operations. and to indeed deny equal rights to those who are disproportionately affected by those nuisance conditions. The question of the scope of agricultural operations is an important one, because the state of North Carolina, unfortunately, does not know the location, its own environmental agency does not know the location of many of the poultry operations that are in this state. Often, they are co-located with the hog operations we've been discussing. As you alluded to, the hog operations are predominantly concentrated in low-income and minority communities, predominantly in southeastern North Carolina. And the residents near these facilities experience significant impacts to their quality of life, many of which Naima discussed. But it is important to note that this bill would reduce remedies, would reduce property rights for nuisance victims across the state, because it applies to any nuisance caused by any agricultural or forestry operation, which do span from the mountains to the coast.
Why isn't this act illegal?
Well, there are certainly concerns regarding its legality, and ultimately that may be tested in the courts. What we have heard from bill proponents is that they believe this law is necessary to protect small farmers from frivolous lawsuits filed by out-of-state interests seeking to bleed the industry dry. And none of those four features is accurate. First, none of the pending lawsuits are against small farmers. They're instead against the large billion-dollar corporation that is producing this meat. Secondly, there are existing statutory protections against malicious or frivolous lawsuits filed in nuisance against agricultural operations. Third, the lawsuits are being brought by North Carolina lawyers based in Salisbury, North Carolina. And fourth and most importantly, the attempt here is not to drive this industry out of North Carolina. Agriculture has been and will continue to be an important part of our economy. However, no industry is worth the impacts of on public health and the environment that we have seen in this industry. And so the attempt here is not to bleed that industry dry, but instead to make sure that that industry is conducted, that these operations are managing waste in a way that doesn't harm their neighbors.
I want to go to another clip from Mark DeVries' investigation into Smithfield Foods factory farms. This is Steve Wing, associate professor of epidemiology at the University of North Carolina's Giddings School of Public Health.
It can, I think, very correctly be called environmental racism or environmental injustice that people of color, low-income people, bear the brunt of these practices.
So, Will Hendrick, this bill, HB 467, was passed by both houses of the North Carolina legislature. It now goes to be signed by the new Democratic governor, Cooper. What is your understanding of what he will do?
Well, we are urging him to veto this legislation. And of course, that decision is his, and he has to act by this Sunday. We're hoping that he'll step in and be the champion of the people that he campaigned to be. We saw in the McCrory administration concerns about willingness to protect corporate interests over the people of North Carolina. And the coal ash saga was an important part of the electoral season and the campaign dialogue. Similarly, we saw concern by North Carolina voters in response to attempts to decrease the civil rights of many North Carolinians in the HB2 fiasco. Governor Cooper rose to power, was put into office by North Carolinians believing that he would be a champion for the little guy, that he would not kowtow to these large corporations, that he would not solely be the governor for the well-heeled, but be the governor for all Tar Heels. In the Tar Heel state.
Black babies cost less. In King County, Black and Native American babies are more than twice as likely to die as white infants before their first birthdays. Public health officials say breastfeeding is one key to lowering infant mortality rates, including sudden infant death syndrome. From KUOW's Race and Equity team, Ann Dornfeld met a woman who's helping women of color teach each other to breastfeed.
Baby Darius is hungry.
Just want to get his hand kind of under your breast so you can kind of hug it.
Cami Goldhammer is helping Darius's mother hold her five-week-old baby at a comfortable angle that lets Darius relax and focus on drinking milk.
So we really want him kind of nipple to nose. Look at that.
Like a lot of babies, Darius had a hard time getting the hang of nursing. It can be painful and frustrating for moms, too. That's where lactation consultants like Goldhammer come in. They give moms advice about how to help their newborn latch on comfortably and make sure baby's getting enough to eat. That help can be critical for mothers who are tentative about breastfeeding, like Goldhammer was when she had her first child.
I had not taken a breastfeeding course. I had never really seen anybody breastfeed. No one in my family had done it.
Goldhammer is Native American. She's Sisseton Wahpeton, a tribe from South Dakota. Before she gave birth, she was doing social work focused on issues of attachment and bonding in the Native community. Breastfeeding rates are low among Native women, but Goldhammer thought she'd give it a try.
I had what I call a spiritual awakening, where, I mean, I felt like the fireworks and just like warmth and amazingness, and really felt the presence of all my ancestors with me. I was just like, this is the answer. Like, this is everything. All this work that I've been doing, how has no one ever told me about breastfeeding?
Goldhammer got certified as a lactation consultant and started promoting breastfeeding in the Native community, not just as a way for mothers and babies to bond, but also as a healthy traditional food and a way to lower infant mortality rates. Goldhammer says there are a lot of reasons why breastfeeding rates are lower among many women of color. Studies show that when white women give birth, they're more likely to be given breastfeeding help in the hospital. Many low-income women go back to work soon after giving birth to jobs where pumping milk is difficult or impossible. For women who need help breastfeeding, lactation consultants can be unaffordable or hard to access in certain parts of town. And Goldhammer says women of color can be uncomfortable inviting healthcare providers into their homes, given this country's ugly history with unjust child removals.
If you take your baby to the hospital because you think your baby's not getting enough food, then the next day you might get a knock on the door from CPS for you not taking care of your baby. And so that history is still very recent. So families might be making these decisions on a subconscious level. So many noises.
Angela Tam's parents are Vietnamese refugees. Her husband's family immigrated from Hong Kong. Tam had so many problems breastfeeding her first daughter, Rosalie, that she was stuck at home for the first month, constantly pumping milk to make sure her newborn had enough to eat.
Finally, I gave up on breastfeeding. I posted all my breastfeeding supplies on Facebook to give away.
Goldhammer saw that post and invited Tam to her weekly drop-in lactation clinic, which now meets in Renton. Before then, Tam had only had white healthcare providers for her baby.
I think breastfeeding's so intimate. You bare your breast to a stranger that comes in to help guide your baby to your breast again and again, maybe 1,000 times over. So I think having a person of color be a part of, a really intimate part of our journey, it takes a little bit of the scariness that comes with being vulnerable out of the equation.
Goldhammer helped Tam figure out that Rosalie had a difficult-to-diagnose tongue tie and other issues that interfered with nursing. It took a while, but Rosalie was finally able to nurse.
You want some milk? I can give you some milk.
Today, Tam is successfully nursing her second daughter, Geneva. And Goldhammer is training other women of color to become lactation consultants.
What amount would you, like, say is a normal range for, like, around a 6
So 1 to 1.5 ounces an hour of separation.
Okay.
You know?
But like, 3 interns are taking notes during today's drop-in clinic. Kristen Travis is Black and a doula. She was inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement to help bring breastfeeding knowledge to the Black community.
I'm really enjoying the fact that Cammie's very hands-on, you know, showing this is how the mouth should be shaped and this is what you should look for. All of those things are things that are completely new to me, and I am just soaking up as much as possible.
Goldhammer doesn't charge her interns for the training, but she does expect them to take on interns themselves once they're certified.
Historically, this is how you would have gotten that information, is by learning from someone in your community, and that information is free.
Goldhammer says she sees breastfeeding knowledge as a human right, and she says there's too much at stake to require people to pay for it.
We see breastfeeding as a life and death for communities of color and an essential part of closing our health disparities.
In the Rainier Valley, I'm Ann Dornfeld, KUOW News.
Clinton pushed something down a young gal's throat. Yeah, and since we talking about throats, white folks, what you know about ropes? Yeah, what you know about trees and men swinging from them that look like me?
In 1947, a group of white men in Greenville, South Carolina, kidnapped and murdered a young black man named Willie Earle. Dozens of men confessed to the crime. They said it was retaliation after a white cab driver was stabbed. The mob falsely accused Willie. Soon after Willie's death, the men responsible were acquitted by an all-white jury. In his new book, Professor Will Willimon looks at the murder through the lens of a preacher. He explores how local clergy responded to the crime and Christianity's role in addressing racism. The book is called Who Lynched Willie Earle? Preaching to Confront Racism. Will Willimon is a professor of the practice of Christian ministry at Duke Divinity School and the former dean of Duke Chapel, and joins us now. Welcome back, Will.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
Tell us more about this book. It looks at the death of Willie Earle and how it unfolded. Let's talk a little bit about the murder itself and kind of what led up to it.
Well, a young man was arrested and placed in the Pickens, South Carolina jail after the stabbing of a Greenville, South Carolina cab driver. The young man was not charged. He was awaiting charges in that stabbing. The first night he was in jail, a mob, really, of Greenville, South Carolina cab drivers came over to Pickens, about 15 miles away, and they took him out of the jail with no resistance from the jailer. And they took him a few miles between the Pickens and Greenville county lines, and they tortured him to death and called the African-American mortician in town and said, you can find his body on the side of the road. Immediately thereafter, legal proceedings were brought against these cab drivers who really bragged about they saw themselves as doing a great righting a wrong against their fellow cab driver, Tom Watson, who had been stabbed. Tom Watson later died a few days later. But then a trial was held in Greenville 3 months later that attracted international attention. Rebecca West came down and wrote a historic piece for The New Yorker called Opera in Greenville. All the cab drivers were acquitted, even though they had signed confessions. And I came into this story, really. I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina. Nobody ever mentioned this to me, and I found out about this lynching and the trial, really a double tragedy, as a college student. And that became a kind of lifetime fascination with it.
Now, why has it taken you this long to write about it?
Well, good question. In a way, the book is sort of a story of my own coming to terms, not only with this part of history, but with myself and my own upbringing in a white supremacist, segregationist society that was South Carolina in the 1940s. And one thing that the catalyst that really got me moving was the massacre at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston. That week after, I wrote about a dozen Methodist pastors that I knew in South Carolina who had all been students of mine at Duke Divinity School, and I asked them, did you mention this in your sermon Sunday? All of them had, and they sent me copies of their sermons. And I was very moved by these attempts of modern day preachers to attempt to speak to this horrible event and to speak about race. And so that propelled me actively to produce this book. And I mean the book to be a kind of confession of my own growth in the matter of race in the South, and also a call to contemporary preachers, an encouragement, giving them ammunition, guidance, and how to speak about race to Christian people today in America.
Well, you also talk about one preacher who was speaking to his congregation then, Holly Lynn and his son.
Yeah. Holly Lynn, this is really the story that occupies me in the book. Holly Lynn was a young Methodist preacher fresh out of Yale Divinity School who had been sent by the bishop to Pickens, South Carolina, Grace Methodist Church. Holly, the backstory there, his wife died giving childbirth to their first child a couple of months before February 1947. So he was there raising an infant himself and with the help of the church members. His church had burned, Grace Methodist had burned about a month before. They were meeting in the high school agricultural room. Well, despite all of this, when the lynching occurred in Pickens, Holly immediately called a public meeting at the high school. That meeting broke up really into was broken up by a mob from a nearby town who said the lynchers should be praised for what they did rather than condemned. And undeterred, young Holly went right back to his parsonage and started working on a sermon. And that sermon was Who Lynched Willie Earle, became the title of my book. In the sermon, Holly basically says, starts out, as we preachers sometimes do, setting it up, saying, who lynched Willie Earle? Well, we know who did it. It was a group of people from another county, embarrassed our county by doing this. But then he turns in the sermon to say, no, we know who lynched Willie Earle. We did. With our segregationist laws, with our economic suppression, repression, with our racist jokes and comments. And he ends with a kind of ringing Christian call to for repentance and for conversion on the issue of race. I could only find one other preacher in South Carolina, Baptist in Spartanburg, South Carolina, who mentioned this tragedy in a sermon.
What was the response to by his congregation?
Well, that's a good question. Holly, when he was interviewed some years later, and I got to meet Holly Lynn, he was an older pastor when I became a new pastor in South Carolina, Holly did not remember any negative response. He remembered some negative response from some of the townspeople who weren't his church members. But some years later, when a history of Grace United Methodist Church in Pickens was published, they reprinted in its entirety Holly's sermon as a great moment in the history of their church, the only sermon they reprinted.
As you say, you didn't find any other sermons on, or many others, in South Carolina on this particular lynching. What was the public reaction? What was the press saying? What were politicians saying?
Well, the public reaction seemed to be sort of embarrassment. Strom Thurmond was the new governor of South Carolina, a New Deal Democrat at that time, and he said this is horrible, that this has marred our wonderful record of race relations in South Carolina. There would, of course, have been many who would have challenged that statement, African-Americans particularly.
Yeah.
And the papers, most of the papers in South Carolina condemned it, although some said, well, it's a bad thing, but sometimes you have to take matters in the hands. Sadly, my hometown paper, Greenville News, condemned it, but then said, the saddest part of this is now we're going to have northern critics will come in and try to teach us how to manage our race relations. So suddenly they were portraying themselves as the victims in this.
So what have you learned in this? Because I know that you also tell a personal story. As you went back to investigate this, you found that you had more personal connections, closer connections than
you
thought.
One of the lynchers bears my name, Williman, which is not a predominant name, appears to have been a distant relative. Also, I knew people related to the trial. And as I began to uncover this in Greenville, found out it was kind of Greenville's unmentionable dirty little secret that they wished had never happened. But also it sort of mirrored my own growth. I first heard about this when I was a student, a sophomore at Wofford College. And I remember the professor who mentioned it to me said, Greenville, well, they had that lynching. And I said, lynching? And he said, well, that's right. You were only 18 years old. I mean, they only had 18 years to tell you about it. And interesting, they never got around to it. But also, I got to testify to my own struggles to speak up and speak out as a white Methodist preacher, Southerner, about race. And to say that the Christian faith, and I tried to think about these issues in a specifically Christian way, the Christian faith has a lot to say. I mean, for one thing, Jesus Christ, as we've been reminded by James Cone in his book, The Cross and the Lynching Tree, Jesus Christ was a victim of a public killing, a capital punishment. The book was to say, now, what does the Christian faith, what are the resources here to speak up and speak out about race?
Talk about some of this, too. Again, pushing back against the lies and the reaction when the horrible thing does happen, you get a couple of reactions. The first is to say, oh, well, we did this awful thing, but actually now we're the victims because the Northerners are good. The second one is sort of the myth of whodunit, right? I mean, there was a myth even around the Willie Earle lynching that there were some well-uneducated rednecks who did this. But in fact, these are pretty well-educated men.
And that I know that narrative growing up in Greenville. Southerners used to like to say, now, you know, the only reason we have a race problem is we have these poor, uneducated, disenfranchised whites, and education is the answer, or progress, etc. Well, it was a group of very well-educated, sophisticated whites who engineered the trial, which was sort of a double tragedy, and maybe even as great or greater tragedy. And there was a sense in which, as some of the African-American press said of the day, you know, Willie Earle wasn't just lynched by a group of angry men one night. He was also lynched by a group of sophisticated Ivy League-trained lawyers who used the American judicial system to get out of this crime.
We are talking about Will Willimon's latest book, Who Lynched Willie Earle, today on The State of Things.
I thought I asked for an African-American to replace Terry.
You requested an Afro-American?
African-American. Jerry, you know I did. I put it in writing.
I didn't see it. You see it?
If you don't like her, you send her back.
Yeah, you tell her you didn't like her performance because she was white.
What? That's not the point.
Flipper, she's been here for 5 minutes. Give her a chance. This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
We're awaiting the arraignment in the case of Corey Ali Muhammad, the man who said he shot and killed three white men last month in Fresno, California, because, as he told a local news station, white supremacy has to die. His lawyer says he's mentally ill. He's said he's a follower of the Nation of Islam. What does that mean? The Black Nationalist Organization was founded in the early 1900s by Wallace D. Fard, who said he was Muslim, but unlike mainstream Muslims, claimed to be Allah in the flesh. Leadership passed to Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali famously joined in the late 1950s. At the same time, a television documentary, The Hate That Hate Produced, was broadcast. Here's a clip from host Mike Wallace.
A group of Negro dissenters is taking to street corner stepladders, church pulpits, sports arenas, and ballroom platforms across the United States to preach a gospel of hate that would set off a federal investigation if it were preached by Southern whites. What are they saying? Listen.
I charge the white man with being the greatest liar on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest drunkard on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest swine eater on earth.
Our next guest says you have to put that and other language in the context of lynchings and the KKK. But the Southern Poverty Law Center calls the Nation of Islam a hate group. Zain Abdullah is an associate professor of religion and society and Islamic studies at Temple University. Professor, tell us more about the core beliefs of the nation at its founding.
Well, the Nation of Islam sort of combined what we would call religious black nationalism with some of the traditional teachings of Islam globally. So the combination often confounded people because many people weren't accustomed to a kind of nationalist dialogue or rhetoric mixed with religion. And so they always have to sort of unpack that idea that they are Muslims, but they're also addressing a black condition of suffering.
And they believed that there was a paradise on earth that had been destroyed by a wizard who created the white devil. So the white devil, the blue-eyed devil, was a thinking early on in the group, which does differentiate them from the Muslim faith. And as we go through the history, we see the leaders are virulently anti-Semitic, anti-whites. Malcolm X joins the group, but Martin Luther King begins referring to them as a hate group. That's in the late 50s as well. We have so many instances of whites propelled by the KKK or by white supremacists or hate groups killing blacks. Are there other instances of blacks who are members of Nation of Islam killing whites?
Early on in this early history, the 1930s, there was one incident when that happened among the early members. And again, it was a response to the lynching of over 5,000 black people in the South and with no kind of repercussion at all. But since then, though, we actually haven't noticed or heard anything like that. The Nation is a self-defense organization. They believe in self-defense. They don't believe in turning the other cheek. They actually do not believe in perpetuating violence against anyone. What you mentioned earlier about the Nation of Islam cosmology, the creation myth, was just that. It was a way to explain how black people became disempowered, became victims of a white supremacist system. And many people who joined the Nation of Islam did not really rehearse that as much. I mean, they understood the story, but they weren't there for that story. They were there for black empowerment, economic, social kind of unity, fight against police brutality, the kind of social conditions that drew them to the organization.
Well, Malcolm X eventually split from the group because of some of the rhetoric. And along comes Louis Farrakhan, who begins leading the group. And then Malcolm X was assassinated. Did Farrakhan order that?
No. Farrakhan has professed always that he did not order any assassination. But he did admit that he participated in creating a climate that could have produced that kind of result. And he apologized for, you know, being a part of a nation that sought to defend itself against any kind of recrimination.
Farrakhan, though, did go on to build an empire. Educational training programs, self-sufficiency programs, we mentioned, bakeries, restaurants, fish markets, a line of hair and skin products. Where is the Nation of Islam today?
Well, the Nation of Islam today, the main group of the Nation of Islam, because they have some splinter groups, but the main group is headed by Minister Louis Farrakhan out of Chicago.
He still leads it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And they have mosques, as they call them now. They used to call them temples. They have mosques throughout the country, perhaps over 100. They are involved in political activism. They're involved in social critique. They're involved, most importantly, in a kind of moral discipline that they try to rehearse constantly. Mm-hmm. And against they're self-professed Muslims. In 1961, C. Eric Lincoln dubbed them black Muslims, which they rejected. They don't see themselves as black Muslims. They see themselves as Muslims who happen to be racially black.
Well, and don't some Muslims in this country reject them because of the early rhetoric about Jews, about whites?
Well, many Muslims in the Muslim world, or what we call Sunni Muslims or traditional Muslims, reject their rhetoric about God coming in the person of a man.
Yeah.
That's a huge violation in Islam. Also, they rejected them for the way in which they responded to white racism by calling whites devils and seeing them mythically as inherently evil. But again, that response was to the system of white supremacy.
I mean, this was just written not that long after slavery, to put in that context. But what about Farrakhan's words? They linger. Here he talks about Jews. Who are the slumlords in the black community, the so-called Jews? Those false Jews promote the filth of Hollywood that's seeding the American people and the people of the world, bringing you down in moral strength. This is repulsive.
Yes, it is. It is. And Minister Farrakhan has been very controversial around these issues. But he has also tried to put his statements into context. Unfortunately, again, it's political. But he tries to also explain that he's not an anti-Semite. He's not homophobic. He's not a racist. But he does make these controversial statements. Absolutely.
But, you know, we live in a time when people are very critical of President Trump. They say things like words matter. Has the Nation of Islam distanced itself from this kind of white supremacy? We know that there are white supremacist groups who actually over the years tried to embrace the Nation of Islam. Hey, we both want separatism. Right. We both want to be able to say how much we hate the other. That couldn't have been appreciated by members of the Nation of Islam. So is there a move to withdraw earlier words?
Well, the Nation of Islam does not perpetuate hate of whites, but because they respond to white racism. In fact, the idea of calling whites devils predates the Nation of Islam. Mm. Even the Chinese during the Boxer Rebellion called their white oppressors devils. So it's a way of inverting or changing the narrative about demonized peoples or degraded peoples. As you say, words matter. So their words are a reaction to a kind of Jim Crow system. And so this is their response in terms of words.
Well, meanwhile, who do you think the successor to Louis Farrakhan is? In 1995, he led the Million Man March. He was also very controversial when Jesse Jackson was running for president. Jesse Jackson had to disavow him and the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what direction do you think?
And so did President Obama also had to disavow him.
Yep.
As well.
So what direction do you think Nation of Islam goes in now and who might lead it?
Well, he's refused to name a successor at this point, but he does have national leaders among his sons. They actually operate on the national level, and they have also regional leaders as well. So like his spiritual father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, at this point, he has refused to name a successor.
By the way, what do you think about the fact that the Southern Poverty Law Center has listed the Nation of Islam as a hate group?
You know, when I talk to members of the nation, they don't think much of it. They believe that it is a mischaracterization of the group. Farrakhan continually denounces that moniker, that they are a hate group. It's very familiar and reminiscent of the program called The Hate Produced, mm-hmm. in covering the Nation of Islam. And so I think because they're a black nationalist organization, they are seen as also perpetuating the same kinds of prejudice. And I just think that there needs to be more information on that.
Well, but you just cannot whitewash, you'll forgive the term, some of Louis Farrakhan's comments about not just whites, but Jews.
No, right. Yeah. Absolutely.
And gays, yeah. And Catholics.
That's yeah. Right. Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah. That's Zain Abdullah, Associate Professor of Religion and Society and Islamic Studies at Temple, also the author of Black Mecca, The African Muslims of Harlem. Professor, pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
The images that started circulating around that campus today.
The racist messages targeted an African-American sorority, and they were found in more than one location. News 4's Jackie Benson is live for us with more reaction from AU students and leaders tonight. Jackie?
Jim, a campus community meeting is planned for tomorrow, but the sense here tonight is that is not going to be enough.
While most students were cramming for finals,
so there are still people on this campus thinking that they go here or that they're in another hall. And that's just, it just builds a level of fear.
Other students we spoke to call the incidents disheartening.
Some people, I don't know what happened or why they do that, but it's unfortunate.
University officials confirmed the bananas tied with black nooses had lettering that appears to reference Alpha Kappa Alpha, a predominantly black sorority. University President Neil Kerwin released a statement that reads in part, "Racially charged acts of bigotry are done to instill fear and inflict pain in our community, especially at stressful times such as the end of the term. I regret that this happened. Apologize to everyone offended." The university has announced a campus community meeting on Tuesday. Now, this was the very first day on the job for the new Student Government Association president. She is the first African-American woman ever to hold that position. She's also a member of the sorority referenced in this incident. She released a statement, and we expect to hear more from her tomorrow. Live in Northwest, Jackie Benson, News 4.
Every nigger is a star. Every nigger is a star. Who will deny that you and I and every nigger is a star?
Now to a breaking news alert. A Houston man arrested for a hate crime. Harris County deputies say 32-year-old James Scott Lee, tried to attack another man just because he was African-American. The alleged incident happened at an apartment complex in northwest Harris County. Channel 2's Sion Rhodes is there tonight with the details that are just coming out at this hour. Sion?
And the DA's office says it is clear that Lee's own words make it clear that his victim was chosen based on his race and that Lee was acting off of racial hate. James Scott Lee lives at this complex in the 15,000 block of Point Northwest Boulevard. The Harris County DA's office saying Lee attacked a black man here yesterday trying to stab him. Investigators say Lee told the man, quote, "I hate N-words. I'm going to kill me one today." The victim was able to escape Lee by jumping into a car and then locking the door. We talked to a resident who saw Lee in the moments just before the attack.
He was just like running back and forth screaming, "I'm going to kill everybody, die, die, die."
It's shocking still. Even though things have been happening like that lately, it still shocks that people want to do this.
Now, Lee is facing an aggravated assault charge with a hate crime enhancement. That means that if he's convicted, he could serve anywhere from 5 years in prison to life in prison, as opposed to what would have been 2 years to 20 years in prison. The DA's office calling Lee an imminent threat. That's why they asked a judge to put his bond at $250,000. That's about 8 times more than they would normally ask. He is still behind bars tonight, and he has a court appearance tomorrow. Reporting live, Sion Rhodes, KPRC Channel 2 News.
To you all, long live John Africa. This is your brother, Mumia Abu-Jamal, joining you the only way I can right now, on the phone. But I want you to know that all of you, MOVE supporters, MOVE people, all of you, MOVE members, you're in my heart every day because your movement, our movement, has rocked the world from day one to today and continues strong, getting stronger every day. You know, the system thought on May 13, 1985, that they would use the weapons of war to destroy MOVE once and for all. Well, they did their worst. They did their most barbaric. They did their most monstrous attack on Mother's Day, 1985. But guess what? MOVE is still there. The belief in the teachings of John Africa is still there. And the resistance of MOVE members out there, in here, and in other countries is still there. Ramona Africa has spoken at Harvard, Oxford, and more colleges than perhaps she even remembers. The message of MOVE is resounding around the world so that the worst weapons that the state could muster, the worst vile things you can imagine, the killing of babies, did not stop the struggle of the MOVE and the teachings of John Africa. That's a lesson, not for this convention, but for the world, and I am delighted to bring it to you. So I say, on the MOVE, long live John Africa, and I love you all. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We need that perfect hair.
Who exactly are you, man? What's going on? All you do is ask me what the hell I am, who I'm with, what I'm buying. Boys act like a motherfucking cop, man. Shit is bullshit, man. I'm free. I'm free. Let me be free.
I want to be a cop. I want to be a cop.
In Louisiana, it's now up to that state's attorney general to decide whether to charge two white Baton Rouge police officers in last summer's shooting death of a black man named Alton Sterling. The U.S. Justice Department said yesterday they would not. After a 10-month investigation, prosecutors say they couldn't meet the burden of proof necessary to bring federal civil rights charges against those officers. Family members and their lawyers say they're disappointed, but also encouraged because there are new details about the shooting that make it more likely that the state will pursue a criminal prosecution. Joining us now to talk about all this is NPR's Greg Allen in Baton Rouge. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Rachel.
The shooting was almost a year ago, last July. Can you just get us up to speed on what new information has come out since then?
Sure. You'll recall that this happened outside of a Baton Rouge convenience store. Police had reports of a man with a gun there. They arrived at the whole time during the confrontation. Alton Sterling had a gun in his pocket. It was never taken out. But investigators did this long investigation, 10 months, as you say, many witness interviews, careful analysis of six different videotapes, enhancing the sound. And they've come up with kind of some new information in a timeline for what happened there. And a lot of the information focuses on one officer, a man named Blaine Salamone. Shortly after they arrived on the scene to try to control Sterling, get him to comply, Salamone held his gun to Sterling's head, prosecutors say. The lawyers for the Sterling family say that prosecutors told them that Salamone actually threatened to kill Sterling at that point. There was then a struggle. They tasered Sterling twice, the officers did, got him down on the ground. At that point, Salamone said twice he's got a gun. After the second time, he fired three shots into Sterling's chest. Sterling then struggled to get up. As he started to sit up, Salamone fired three more shots in Sterling's back.
So federal prosecutors say they can't meet the burden of proof to file charges. Any more details on what that means?
Well, we had a briefing yesterday from the acting U.S. attorney in the Middle District of Louisiana, Corey Amundson, talked to the family and then later briefed the media. He said because Salamone couldn't be sure Sterling didn't have a gun during this whole encounter, prosecutors can't show that he had willful intent to use unreasonable force to deprive him of his civil rights. Here's what Amundson had to say at his news conference yesterday.
Please know that experienced, highly trained federal agents and prosecutors worked hard to investigate and examine the facts to determine if a federal criminal case could be brought here. We have all concluded that no such case can be brought under federal law.
So now this goes to the state level. You would have thought a state investigation would have happened already. Why is it only happening now?
Well, what's happened is that the Baton Rouge East District Attorney recused himself because he knows Blaine Salamone's parents. He's sent it to the Attorney General, Jeff Landry. He decided to defer this and wait for the federal investigation. Now that that's complete, all the information is being handed to state investigators. But the burden of proof in a state case is much different than a federal civil rights prosecution. Chris Stewart, a lawyer for two of Sterling's children, thinks all this new information about the shooting makes prosecution more likely. Here's what he had to say.
In my experience with these cases, Attorney General Jeff Landry has a phenomenal case against these officers. Not strong, phenomenal case against these officers.
Baton Rouge has been through a lot. I mean, after this shooting, there were days of protests, hundreds of arrests. It's worth remembering there was another tragedy. A sniper shot and killed three police officers. How's this community doing?
Well, it's been quiet yesterday. We had heavy rain all day long. I think there's a sense that the federal prosecution was always a long shot. They're all looking now to the attorney general. But yesterday, Salamone's lawyers said that they think that the state prosecutors will draw the same conclusion, that they can't bring charges.
NPR's Greg Allen reporting in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thanks, Greg.
I want to be a cop. Yeah. I want to be a cop.
Also breaking right now, former North Charleston police officer Michael Slager expected to plead guilty to federal civil rights charges later today. That hearing expected to begin this afternoon at about 2:30. Right now we have team coverage with our Bill Sharp, Liza Lucas, and Harv Jacobs, who are all downtown. So we're going to start first with Bill Sharp. Bill, what are you seeing at the courthouse there?
It's starting to get crowded here outside the federal courthouse, Debbie, on Meeting Street south of Broad, the federal courthouse just behind me. I think this took people by surprise, this expected guilty plea. And I say expected, Debbie, because you never know until it actually happens that there will be a guilty plea. But Michael Slager expected to plead guilty to one count of violating Walter Scott's civil rights. He shot and killed Walter Scott after a routine traffic stop about 2 years ago. Now, Harv Jacobs is joining me now. Harv, I think a lot of people were surprised by this expected guilty plea coming this afternoon.
Bill, I was until I saw that they changed the time of today's court hearing from morning to afternoon. Basically, this is supposed to be a full day of testimony today here to see who would qualify to testify at Slager's federal trial scheduled to begin in 2 weeks. Instead, they moved it to this afternoon, and that's when I started thinking, hey, we may have a guilty plea here. Slager is going to plead guilty, according to my source, to the most serious charges. Bill said, civil rights violations under the color of law. In plain English, that means use of excessive force. The plea agreement apparently also calls for the state murder charges against Slager to be dismissed. That trial is supposed to be scheduled for later this year at the end of the summer. Slager will not be sentenced today. Here's how it works in the federal court system. They will have the plea hearing, and then they'll have what's called a pre-sentencing report. Probation agents will take care of that, Fed probation agents, and Slager will learn his sentence either in a matter of weeks or in a matter of months. Bill, jury selection was supposed to start next Tuesday in Columbia, and we had hotel rooms booked in Columbia for myself and the videographer from Matt Gladwell. It looks like now we can cancel those reservations.
You don't have to worry about going to Columbia, mm-hmm. we expect, anyway. Yeah. Once again, Harv, until this actually happens, until we get that guilty plea, we can't count our chickens until they're hatched. Liza Lucas is covering family reaction. She's already talked to the brother of Walter Scott. There is expected, Liza, to be a news conference after Michael Slager's guilty plea this afternoon.
Bill, we expect the family to come out of that courthouse this afternoon and let us know how they're feeling. But just a month ago, on the anniversary of Walter Scott's death, April 4th, I had the chance to speak with Anthony Scott about how the family was dealing leading up to this federal trial. Now, Anthony said something that we've heard from the Scott family many times before. They are seeking justice. They will have justice. At the same time, Anthony says that he is echoing his family. They are asking for continued peace in the community and throughout the Charleston area. We've seen that so far as we had that state trial. We've seen a lot of reaction from the family reiterating they're calling for peace throughout this process. Let the courts handle it. We expect to have more this afternoon. Whether or not the Scott family will indeed see this possible guilty plea as justice, as the justice they were hoping for, we expect to hear more this afternoon when they address the media, address us, and we'll keep you posted on that, Bill, live and sending it back to you.
All right, Liza, thank you. This just in, this afternoon, Michael Slager will enter a guilty plea for using excessive force in violation of a federal law as he attempted to arrest Walter Scott on April the 4th of 2015, just over 2 hours ago. Now, 2 years ago, I should say. That guilty plea expected in federal court in about 2 hours and 26 minutes right here. We will be in court for that expected guilty plea from Michael Slager. We'll have a live update, complete team coverage, plus reaction from the family coming up right here on Live 5 News at 4. So I'm outside the federal courthouse in downtown Charleston right now, Debbie. I'm Bill Sharp. I'll pass it back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, Bill. Once again, Michael Slager to plead guilty to a charge of use of excessive force. We'll be following this afternoon.
Is that a real gun?
Yes, this is a real gun.
Did he kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true? Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Is it true?
Oliver, there's not a lot of information out there, but we did get a glimpse through an open records request, and in it, we found a memo from the Balch Springs police chief suspending Oliver for 2 days. Now, according to that document, back in 2013, Oliver was supposed to testify in a DUI case. Assistant DAs reported Oliver being angry, hard to contact, and using language so vulgar, the prosecutor had to ask an intern to leave the room. Now, that's a direct quote from the document, by the way. And the last item on that memo, the chief says Oliver responded to a question on the stand, mind you, by saying, quote, "I don't understand the effing question." Stay with News 8 as we continue to follow this case. You'll find background and the very latest information at WFAA.com.
Breaking news at 6, murder charges filed against the former Balch Springs police officer accused of killing a 15-year-old boy.
A judge has signed the warrant late this afternoon. Our Rebecca Lopez live tonight. She's got some new details on all this in our newsroom. Rebecca?
Well, as you mentioned, an arrest warrant was signed this afternoon by a Dallas County judge. Now Oliver can turn himself in to any jail or to any law enforcement officer. The case was being investigated by the Dallas County Sheriff's Office as well as the Dallas District Attorney's Office. A news release was issued, and here's a part of what it says. Mr. Oliver intended to cause serious bodily injury and commit an act clearly dangerous to human life that caused the death of an individual. This all started last Saturday night in Balch Springs when 15-year-old Jordan Edwards was shot and killed after Officer Oliver shot into a vehicle where he was a passenger. Initially, the officer said the vehicle was backing up in an aggressive manner, so he fired a rifle into the vehicle. Later, the chief of Balch Springs said, after reviewing video, that is not what they believed happened. They say the car was driving away. Balch Springs fired Officer Oliver. The DA and the sheriff's office began conducting their own investigation. After speaking to witnesses and the officer, a murder charge was filed, in fact, today. Jordan Edwards' family issued a statement earlier this afternoon saying they were not ready for their son to become a martyr and wanted time to grieve. The viewing of his body is tonight, and the funeral is, in fact, tomorrow. Now, any law enforcement officer can arrest Roy Oliver since there is an active warrant out for him, but most likely his attorney will take him to a jail and turn him in. Now, there's a lot of pressure for District Attorney Faith Johnson to file charges. She said in interviews earlier this week that she would do what she felt was right after conducting their own investigation, and that's exactly what has happened here. Reporting live in the newsroom, Rebecca Lopez. Channel 8 News.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rebecca. Attorney Pete Schulte now, who's also been a Dallas police officer in the past, here to tell us what all of this means. Have you ever in the past heard of anything like this happening where a police officer in uniforms charged with murder?
No, and it's you bring that up. We're talking about an officer-involved shooting where they're in the line of duty. You know, we had the Farmers Branch officer last year, but that was off duty. But there's still an officer that was treated like everybody else, and a murder charge was brought against him. Now, this is rare, but we do expect through the officer-involved shooting process with the DA's office that they delay filing any charges until there's a grand jury proceeding. This, what happened today, is rare, but I think it's warranted under the situation.
Now, we saw the police chief of Balch Springs at the very beginning of the week. He came out and he said that he defended his officer, and then he had a chance to look at the videotape and did a 180.
He did. And I'll tell you, you know, this is a lesson to all police chiefs. I think it's great that the Balch Springs police chief was getting out there trying to be transparent, let people know what was going on. But when you have all the evidence available to you, you need to review it. And I think probably what happened in a small agency like that, he went and interviewed the officers. The officers told them what they were perceiving or what they believe had happened. And he didn't go back to confirm it until later. He went back, watched the videos, and again, like you said, did a complete 180. That's a concern. That was a mistake. But now we know more. We don't have all the facts yet. I mean, again, he was charged today with murder just based on what we call probable cause. That's not a whole lot of evidence. There's a lot can go on before we get to beyond a reasonable doubt at a trial.
Now, it wasn't just murder that he could have been charged with, but maybe some other things as well. But murder seemed to be the strongest of the ones that they had in terms of options. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Intentionally or knowingly causing the death of an individual. That's the murder statute, but it's all under the parameters of homicide. So you have murder, then you have manslaughter, then you have criminally negligent homicide. And that's all based on the person's what we call mental intent. Do they intentionally or knowingly do it? Did they cause it recklessly, or they do it with criminal negligence? And that also goes back to what the charges are, whether it's a first-degree felony, a second-degree felony, or even a state jail felony, which is our lowest level felony. But usually, in all cases with murder, they start off at the murder charge and let the jury decide if they think the mental intent was different, and then the jury can find what we call lesser-included offense of either manslaughter or criminally negligent homicide.
You've said that we have not seen all of the evidence in terms of this case, but one of the key things seems to be the videotape itself, which we have not seen, but the chief has seen, and now the district attorney has seen.
I think the video is crucial. I think the fact that, you know, initially that was reported to the police chief that the car was backing up in an aggressive manner is not supported by the evidence, and that's kind of the sign of the times, that the technology for police, the body cams, the in-car video footage, has gotten so much better over the years that, you know what, when I write a report as an officer now, I'm going to make sure I go watch the video, because again, what you're perceiving as an officer could be different than what is actually happening. And with Officer Oliver's situation, he was a paramilitary combat veteran, so you wonder if during that time that he got into a PTSD-type deal and not observing what was actually going on, but his perception was different. So we have to wait for those facts to come out. But even if it was a mistake from his military experience, it doesn't justify the charge. So the murder charge is appropriate.
Okay, one more question, if we can. Jim Allen of Fort Worth, a very prominent attorney. He's done a lot of work with police officers. He is an attorney. What happens next in terms of this for them?
You know, I imagine with Jim having the context that he has in Tarrant County, any county jail of the 254 counties can accept Officer Oliver into jail and serve the warrant, which I expect will happen tonight. If he goes to Tarrant County, he could slide in, get booked in and booked out. It depends what the bond is set at. Well, that's the next step. I don't think we're all going to know where he turns himself in.
All right. Pete Schulte reporting for us. And thanks a lot, Pete. Thanks again,
a
police officer giving us that experience and also, of course, an attorney familiar with the law. Thank you very much.
Welcome, John.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 6th, 2017. So I have been told this is our weekly compensatory call-in. If you have views, comments on some of the news items, events that took place over the last 7 days, counter-racist suggestions, feel free, dial in the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get started, a few quick things. Number one, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested 8+ years. I hope the broadcast has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Thanks to all the folks who got items from our wish list as well. It's on Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. And that has been helpful. Got lots of books and items as well. A few things that stood out. First up, I feel like I was hearing kind of at the beginning of the year, some folks, and I think even it happened on the compensatory call-in where some people were saying they felt there had been a lag in terms of it seemed like for a while we were daily seeing reports and body camera footage or cell phone video of a black person having some sort of brutal encounter with enforcement officers, where another white race soldier has killed a black person or tased, beaten, choked, whatever it is, to a black person. And it seemed like that had vanished for a brief period of time, kind of starting at the beginning of the year up to now. Some people had been saying that, even saying that it seemed to correlate with when President Trump went to the White House. And just I've said for a long time, I'm not someone who focuses a lot of attention on the police thing, just because I've seen that under the system of racism, white supremacy, enforcement officers killing and mauling black people, that has to happen. It's going to happen. And there's not a whole lot that can be done about that as long as this system exists. The most that you can do is just try to minimize the likelihood of it happening to you by just doing little things here and there. I try to recommend some of those things, not going out late in the evening, not being under the influence, intoxicated if you're going to be behind the wheel, buckle your seatbelt, just little things that you can try to do, knowing information if you do get stopped in terms of your tone of voice, words that you use, things that you say, saying that you do not consent to searches, just little things to try to minimize having unnecessary difficulties or some sort of violent contact with a potential race soldier. But this stuff is going to happen, and it's a long record that whites are just committed to getting that badge, getting that nigger knocker, and going to work on black people. In that, related to that, I think maybe 2 weeks ago, I think it was right in April, springtime of 2017, I had been saying that I was contemplating going outside. It was about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. I was going to go outside right in front of my house, not going too far, just, you know, a couple blocks. And I was conflicted about it because I've seen enforcement officers out. And, you know, I told you a non-white, non-black, non-white person was like, you know, you can't live your life in fear. You get out there to go. And I said I went outside. Within, I think, 10 minutes of being outside, enforcement officer rolled right by me. I said, see there? And I promptly went back in the house at that point. But when I saw this case with Jordan Edwards, a 15-year-old black child who was shot and killed by an enforcement official while he was seated in a vehicle, unarmed, not doing anything crazy, not doing anything illegal, being sober, I remember that incident immediately. And Dr. Kamau Kamban, make sure I get that out as well, visit his website, www.kamaukamban.org. He was last with us on our 8-year anniversary this February. But he said repeatedly, he said this for black children and older black people, saying, hey, once the sun goes down, it's after, you know, 10 o'clock, you probably don't want to go out if you don't need to. If it's an emergency, you have a sick family member or something like that, and you got to get something really quick. It's something that you need to prepare for a job, or something that, you know, maybe a child or somebody needs to prepare for school tomorrow, what have you, and you just got to run out really quick and get something from the store. Okay. But I mean, just going out and joy riding and riding around, going to parties, going to bars and things of that nature. Dr. Kamban has just emphasized for a long time, it would be great to go and do that stuff if war wasn't being waged against us. And the evidence just shows consistently that being in those sort of situations, whether it's other victims of racism, a lot of times we don't treat each other well when it's late at night and people are intoxicated. A lot of times that can cause problems. Sometimes those problems can bring armed race soldiers with their nigger knockers, and that can make even more problems. I think that happened 2012. If folks remember Bo Morrison, there was a house party that took place, I think this was in Wisconsin, and same type of deal. Younger people were there. They were partying. It was late at night. Police got called. He went and hid in a house trying to get away from the police. The person's house where he was hiding at, white person, went out, shot and killed him. Wasn't doing anything, just going out having a good time. Same sort of thing. I think in North Carolina, I think last year, remember there was the case with the black male, same type of deal. House party, he went. No big deal. I think cannabis was rumored to have been being consumed or involved. Not even, you know, no one should die over that. But just saying, cannabis is not legal in North Carolina. So I think when the enforcement officials got called, I think that was a influencing variable that caused some of the non-white people present to run or scatter or whatever the case may be. But it ended up with a black person being shot right there. It's just a lot of these incidents, too many times, things end up going bad. I would use this. It's horrendous that this happened to this young 15-year-old down in Texas. This race soldier, Roy Oliver, has been charged. We'll see how that plays out. Racists can do a lot of tackiness once things get to the courtroom, which has been demonstrated repeatedly, especially involving police officers. But we'll see how that plays out. But I mean, even if they, you know, gave him the death penalty and, you know, killed him on national television at the end of the week, that would not bring back Jordan Edwards. So I would just, my suggestion would be, if you are a parent, if you have younger people that you care about, use some of these incidents where younger people are out. Renisha McBride would be another one. Use some of these incidents to try to impress upon young people. I know you want to have fun. You know, all of us were younger at some point, and some of us older are still going out and having a good time. All well and good, understandable. Just when you do that, you need to remain codified. War is being waged against us. You got to understand that. I know that can be very, very difficult for some young people to understand, and for a lot of older people to understand. War is being waged against us, and you just have to take that seriously, and that might mean that you end up having to compromise your fun sometimes. All I can say is, well, that fun, going out to that party, and maybe you get a few numbers, see some cute folks, okay, maybe all that good stuff happens. You would be surprised how frequently for black people the fun gets interrupted by racism. I will stop there. Continuing. Coming up this week, last week we had a reschedule. We were supposed to have a program on Tuesday with Dr. Howard Stevenson. He's a black male at the University of Pennsylvania. He does a lot talking about the importance right on cue of teaching younger black children, in particular teaching them about racism, white supremacy, and how to deal when they have these moments where they're being mistreated, so they have better strategies, better response strategies. He was supposed to be with us this past Tuesday. He had to reschedule. He'll be here this coming Tuesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And Pam, one of our favorites, co-author of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, The Interracial Con Game, The Beauty Con Game, Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation. She will be back, one of our favorite guests, on this coming Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. She was supposed to have been with us repeatedly. I think this will be her first time visiting with us this calendar year, but she was supposed to have been with us earlier in the year. I think I've reported repeatedly that she was not feeling very well. I think the first time we had to reschedule, and then she had a death in the family. It was kind of a tough 2017 for her, at least the early portion of it. But she has persevered, continued to work diligently, and she should be with us on Wednesday. So we'll be looking forward to let folks know, one of the Cow's favorite guests for the past 8 years, Pam, back with us on Wednesday. With that, I will again remind listeners for this program, if we cannot use metaphors, I've seen consistently racists, they do a phenomenal job of using comparisons, analogies, metaphors, to suggest that two things are similar or equal when they absolutely are not. And I mean, they do this. You can almost, you can guarantee almost that racists will do this when a conversation on racism comes up. We've had a lot of white guests do this. Victims of white supremacy, non-white people, we are influenced by racists' behavior, and we are still learning what racism is, how it works. I think many of us, myself first and foremost, many of us in trying to articulate our views or thoughts on white supremacy, we end up using a metaphor in the hope that that will correctly convey our thoughts, and often it does not, and it just produces more confusion. And again, comparing things, equating things that are not similar. If we could just be direct, explicit, direct to what we are trying to say, that would be grand. I will prompt about that. Thank you kindly. For folks listening, if you could take approximately 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts, views that you have, that would be great. That way everyone will get an opportunity to share. Please don't wait till the last minute, and make sure that you don't have a lot of background noise. If you're someplace where it's a lot of other people, or people are watching TV, or have, you know, music noise in the background, if you could use your mute button if you know you're in a noisy environment, and then just unmute when you want to say or ask your question, whatever you want to share, and then mute yourself again. That just helps preserve the quality of the broadcast. With that, we will go ahead and get to the folks who dialed in. Number one more time is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I will say quickly, that segment that you heard about the importance of getting maternal care for non-white females, non-white people in general, but particularly expecting moms, that was here in Washington State, the Seattle area. I can say, having spent a good portion of my 2017 around a pregnant black mother, now a new mom who will be celebrating her first Mother's Day next weekend, I can say that she and other non-white people would strongly disagree that this area does not have a wealth of resources, and even sometimes the resources that are set up for black mothers, black parents, first-time moms, or what have you, those resources, even then, it's tons and tons and tons of race soldiers on the staff who are there, who are the ones who are working there, who are the ones that you got to go to get information and what have you. I can say that directly, knowing and being able to put my hand on a pregnant black mom and other non-white people who have children, first-time mothers and what have you, they can say that those resources are real shabby in this area, and that there even seems to be some skillful racism with this being another racket where it's a resource ostensibly for non-white people, but white people end up coming in and getting the jobs and all the goodies from this. Just wanted to make sure I got that in, because that is very, very important. Black babies cost less. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary to share, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus, for the program this evening. Good evening to everyone here this evening. This is a student who is learning. Let's be clear. White people have willful intent to profit off of black bodies, dead and alive, in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, and war. In this system of racism, white supremacy. Let's be clear, white people are not pained by terrorizing black people in any area of people activity. This is not a workplace racism story, but I had an interesting incident happen to me this week at work that caught me by surprise. Part of my job responsibility is to meet with employee organizations on a regular basis to provide them information regarding the department I work for. After the meeting, a black male approached me to tell me that he had heard me on the calls. I asked him what he was talking about and why he thought it was me on the calls. He stated that to me that I recognized that voice anywhere. He further stated that he listened to the calls and Nellie Fuller on a regular basis, and that the calls program and Nellie Fuller helped him navigate the daily minefields of racism and white supremacy in the workplace. I stated to him that I concur, and then I walked away. My point for sharing this story is to say that black people have to stay focused on a code of thought, speech, action, and emotional response over and over again, even with other black people. So if that black male is listening to me now, continue to practice self-respect. We are all still learning. Gus, can I do the prayer this evening?
Sure thing. Just give me a reminder in case I'm a victim, in case I forget.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Other folks that have a hand up that we have not heard from, if you have a comment, thoughts you want to share, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys, and to the rest of the callers. So I remember seeing recently on social media another one of Donald Trump's rants or speeches, whatever you want to call it, but he was basically talking about the Holocaust and how we can never forget about it. It's like one of the important parts of American history. I'm paraphrasing what he's saying, but he was basically saying all this stuff about the Holocaust, saying we can never forget it. It was like the key point of American history or even world history. In fact, that's what I got from it. And I just thought to myself, well, what made the fabric of the United States of America, what shaped the United States of America? It wasn't the Holocaust. It was slavery, African slavery itself in the United States. I don't see how he could be, like, I don't see how he could be fighting for us, specifically black people, if he does not explain how slavery is one of the things we can't forget. He goes on and on about the Holocaust, but nothing about slavery. I feel like that's just not surprising, but it's interesting to hear from our most recent president, the one who's trying to make America, quote-unquote, great again. But it's just kind of confusing to me. Well, not confusing, but like kind of new to hear this from a president, because now that he's in office, I've been paying more attention to like what he's doing, because I feel like he's trying to get us killed, like everybody in the United States killed for some, I don't know why, but that's his explanation that he's not explaining. But yeah, that's my rant about Donald Trump. But also about Jordan Edwards, we were talking about this in our club, Black Student Union, and when I heard about this incident, I really just realized that I'm more of a target now, because I heard that he was an honor roll student at his high school, sophomore, I think. And I am also an honor roll sophomore student in a high school. So he was at a party and he got shot in the back of the head and he didn't even do anything. And I feel like that the same thing can happen to me. That's why I realized I have to be more careful. I was taught this, but I never put it into action. And now I just realized I should put those things into action. Just hearing about this incident, and it's just another thing about police brutality. Nobody's going to do anything about it. It's just going to keep going on and on forever until genocide occurs with black people. But yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Right on. This is our young scholar in the Bay Area. He is called regularly. Sometimes he just writes his comments. I'll just say this is from our young scholar in the Bay Area. But that's exactly why I started with that when I was giving my comments a few minutes ago, that I think if we have parents, or if you're an educator, you work with young people, if you have nieces, nephews, cousins, whatever, younger people that you care about, you know, use this incident. And unfortunately, there will probably be others that you can use. To just say, hey, if it's me or your parents or some other black people that care about you, and they're saying, you know, hey, they are talking to you about not being out late, and they want you to respect your curfew, and, you know, you want to go out and have a good time and all that stuff, but it's war. It would probably be, you know, slightly different if we were not in a system of racism, white supremacy. But exactly, you can be an honor roll student, a high school standout athlete with your whole future ahead. You know, you got scholarships lined up, going to college, academic scholarships, athletic scholarships, everything lined up, and racists don't care. You're just another nigger. I don't care. 10, 12, 15. That, you know, unfortunately, should more of us should have that understanding and apply it in our thought, speech, action, and emotions. Other folks that we have not heard from, line should be open. Feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, this is the female caller from Ohio. Thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. I just had a few notes. I did get to listen to the segments this week. The first thing that I wanted to talk about, or the first thing that, I don't know, I don't want to use a metaphor. So what the North Carolina State Representative said, Jimmy Dixon, the part about the pig farms, basically, and how he just said, you know, close your eyes and imagine the smell to be different foods. And the last food that he mentioned was fried chicken. I definitely thought that, you know, that was definitely a codified way of basically saying to black people, you know, just get over it, how it wasn't really, you know, the smell wasn't really a problem, and you're just, it's just aggravation. It's not something that it should be affecting your lives all that much. And it just made me think about when I was going to school not that far away from a pig farm, and especially in the summer times when it would get really, really hot and we would have to go outside for gym. It was just, I don't think they were doing the same thing as these pig farmers were doing in North Carolina, because it was in a different state that I went to high school, but the smell was just unbearable. So, and I was just only going to school there, so it's not like something that I had to live, I had to be exposed to this environmental racism like the people are being those two in North Carolina. So I definitely thought that that was ridiculous. I did appreciate the segment about breastfeeding because my sister, she definitely works very hard when it comes to breastfeeding her child. And I thought that Kristen Travis is definitely practicing Black self-respect, wanting to learn this new skill so that way she could help Black people in her community, especially Black women. I have known from other Black women, because I'm not a mother, but other Black women who have also had to deal with race soldiers, helping them when it comes to breastfeeding. And I can definitely understand if they had some uncomfortability about that. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the interview with Robin Young and the professor Zane Abdullah. I definitely felt like Robin Young was practicing racism, especially with the fact that, making the professor admonish the Honorable Louis Farrakhan before the interview ended, and also asking him Louis Farrakhan actually ordered the hit or the assassination on Malcolm X, as if, you know, he would have more insight on that than I'm assuming law enforcement or what have you. That's just how I took it. I could definitely be wrong. And just the fact of comparing Louis Farrakhan to Trump also seemed like that was practicing racism. The last thing was that how she brought up the comments that Louis Farrakhan made, and just about Jewish, white people who classify themselves as Jewish. And it made me think about just really how the white people in the music industry, the ones who are practicing or the ones who classify themselves as Jewish, are putting how they're, you know, just further practicing racism and letting younger Black men say all different types of horrible things about, you know, other Black men and women, and just different horrible songs that I heard recently about a Black male, what he would do to a Black female as far as physical, you know, hurting the person physically, and how that was all right. But then white people pulled or did not allow Lupe Fiasco's CD come out because of one line that wasn't really all that bad. So it just, I could definitely start to see like just the racism, white supremacy, and just all areas of people activity. That's all I had. Thank you for letting me share.
I know, I appreciate that. Other folks that we have not heard from at all who have a hand up?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, good evening. Thanks so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having a good evening. I, again, appreciate the clips. I wanted to talk about, I guess, the first clip with the licensing for the architects. I think, like, to me it was surprising because as an accountant, I have a professional license, whatever. And when I went to school, I didn't really know what major I was, the person that would be accountant. I said, okay, whatever. And, you know, I didn't know what it took. But, you know, it seemed reasonable, so I did it, and it was great. So far, so okay. But I didn't know it took, like, all that time, and then I looked online while the report was being discussed, and they have, like, an internship. And, you have to go to – in the United States, you have to go to school for, like, 5 years, 3 years of internship, then some exam. So at the minimum, it's 8. And I think that young man said it took him 11. And it did, the article online, it said, yeah, it takes people usually 11, even though the minimum was 8. And I think a lot of times Black people who do not have the resources, who do not know what it takes to become whatever type of professional, you know, you realize it may take, quote unquote, too long. You know, you don't have the finances to sustain it. And so that's one of the reasons that people don't do that. So I don't have a parent, but if you know you have a child, we really have to prepare for our children, not just, oh, you know, the well-being and things like that, but for their careers. If they tell you they want to be such and such, you need to start helping them research that right away and learn to be patient, and don't ask them, well, when are you going to be done? When are you going to be done? You find out what it takes and be patient. And other things that may you know, we don't think about how these things go on together. The fact that if you go to school for 5 years, let's say you graduate 18, college for 5 years, you're 23, 3 years of internship, 26. So now, fortunately, that all that time, your health insurance is covered by the ACA, and I don't think they're taking that away with this new plan or whatever it is. You're still going to get that coverage, and that makes an impact because if you're an intern, you probably don't get the same pay as regular people, and you don't have that opportunity. You know, that could be a future problem to you, health insurance and things like that, coming up with those costs. So those are things you have to think about. And also, with it taking so long for that, then you're less likely to be an entrepreneur because, again, just the time and knowing growing up in a lower income, you don't have the luxury of time to earn money. You're trying to, you know, if you have half a heart, you're trying to help, you know, help your mom, help your dad, help whoever around you. And those are things that we need to think about. And I'm not saying don't become an architect. I'm not saying that at all because, of course, the other side to that is we need the architects to go into some of these depressed our neighborhoods to prevent them from becoming gentrified, because if we went in, we can fix them up and we can sell them. You know, that architect is an important part of developing the properties as well. So just, I guess, in short, make sure whatever you feel you know someone's going into, be supportive and just be patient, because some particular fields take a while, and teach it and know which fields you need to go to college for. I work at a school. I think college is great, and I get paid well. But, you know, it's not for everybody, depending on what you need to do. So be mindful of that, because that is an expense as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I used to have a crush on a very attractive black female who happened to be an architecture student. And we had a lot of conversations. I'm still in contact with her. We had lots of conversations about her being generally the only black student in the class, or maybe it would be two of them. She was moving through all the coursework, and I mean, she could tell you a lot. I even talked, because it was a black person, I think, who did the architectural design for the Smithsonian, the new African-American History Museum that opened last year. But I think a black person did that design, and he was talking about the same thing, the racism he experienced. But yeah, she was saying, my pal, she was saying that her classmates were like white students where their dad had like their own architecture firm, and they knew everything because they had worked with him. I mean, the same thing that you hear for a lot of other disciplines. But yeah, absolutely. The whole discipline of architecture, like everything else, dominated by the system of white supremacy. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, what's going on, Gus? And to all the callers and listeners, this is Greg calling from St. Louis. I just wanted to chime in on a few of the clips. Just kind of going back to the architecture clip, just talking about, like, industry. I know my brother is a graphic designer. He just came from a conference. And, the first day he called me, he was like, man, it's like, no black people at this conference. And he said during the conference, they kept talking about how to get, you know, the industry of design more diverse, and how to get, you know, now white people kind of in the industry, and how to get their firms and agencies to hire more black people. So, you know, that whole, like Gus, you just brought up, you know, all these industries, you know, we have black people tend to be like a low percentage. And kind of going with the white woman that was commenting on, you know, us not knowing what black architecture, the designers did, what made what buildings. She was saying, you know, who really cares? I think white people admire buildings, and they name them, and they make sure that they put the stamp of who built those on those buildings and talk about it. So I think she definitely was practicing racism by saying, who cares if, you know, we know who built it or who was behind the design. Going to the clip with the white author that wrote the book regarding the lynching, I kind of started laughing because I think Gus brought up a fact that how white people, you know, they write these books about these events, but then they kind of put their feelings and their thoughts in the book. And then the book kind of becomes a reflection story about their life. So I thought that was interesting. Kind of going to the Nation of Islam clip. The white woman definitely was being tacky, you know, by asking those questions. And I tend to feel white people want to always put that, you know, non-white black people, you know, we practice racism and we are black supremacists and, you know, we are anti this and anti that, you know, kind of to throw it, you know, to put it in front of us and then kind of poke at us and say, you know, you guys do the same thing. So I thought that was very tacky of her with that interview. Kind of going to some recent events in St. Louis, the Ferguson protester activist Edward Crawford that was heavy involved in the Mike Brown protest was found dead a few days ago. They say he committed suicide. You know, so it's kind of some talk as if that's really true. Now he's maybe like the sixth or seventh Ferguson protester that's been found dead. So, you know, if you haven't heard about that, definitely look into it. And that's all I had.
For folks who don't know, Edward Crawford, if people remember from everything that went down in Ferguson, that picture of the black male picking up, I think it was tear gas or the canister of whatever it was that they were throwing at the protesters. He picked it up and threw it back. I believe that was Mr. Crawford, Mr. Harris just reported, died this week under suspicious circumstances. I'll post the link so people can read more about that also. Do we have other folks that we have not heard from, have a hand up, have commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. The one clip that I really wanted to kind of talk about, because I was thinking about it a lot, was the breastfeeding clip. I did not get to participate in the medical apartheid reading, but I do have the book and I do plan to read it. But if she talks about it, that'd be great. But if not, I feel like it's that as well. For instance, I was not breastfed. My mother was not breastfed. I think my grandmother might have been breastfed, but that's two generations. And there are certain things that the baby gets from the mother's milk. And so you have these autoimmune deficiencies or states, really, like a hypersensitivity to allergens. You can have eczema and asthma. And so when I look, when I'm working with people at, you know, certain conditions in which prevalent in our community, eczema and asthma are really up there. And breast milk has actually been scientifically proven to help that because it helps to strengthen the baby's immune system. And I remember I looked into it. I'm not a mom. I don't have any children. But I do read a lot about motherhood and children. And I just wanted to say this in case there are, like, women out there who aren't aware of it, but, like, on Instagram and Facebook, if you just Google black women do breastfeed, there's, like, a ton of different pages that black women have gotten together, and they take pictures, and they provide information, and you can ask questions, and people will help. So if you're kind of isolated, the Internet's a great place to find information. But I just was thinking about that and, like, the generational deficiencies that will happen. So it's that slow-term kind of death that the system of white supremacy creates within the black community. And then it helped me think a little bit more about the clip about the pig feces spray. Sometimes they kill outright really fast, and other times it's really a slow one. Like, I don't even know what the health toxicity rate must be, like, even inside the home, like, because they said they had to close the door, and then, like, your filters, and then all the stuff that you're breathing, if you turn the air on to try to filter it out, do they have to walk with masks, like, what happens if it gets in your eye, like, there's so many things to consider about that, And it's really like not small at all. And so those are the two things that kind of really, really stuck out to me, because we suffer so much. We suffer so much, and even really small things like that. Like, I don't know how I would feel with a white woman touching me, trying to show me how to do it in terms of getting a baby to latch and stuff like that. But they're and I think this would be the last thing I wanted to say, that there's a lot of credibility to black women having fear of allowing white people, specifically the women, into the home to, like, help, because they're always trying to snatch the babies and take the babies and call CPS and all this other kind of stuff. But then the last thing is, I wanted to say this and I almost forgot, that in the hospitals, they'll tell black women not to breastfeed and that their milk isn't nutritious enough. And they'll provide formula, and a lot of times it's soy-based, which has its own issues. I've even read about in other countries where these, like, so-called healthcare professionals will go in and tell the women not to breastfeed and to give their babies formula, which means that we have to spend all this money on formula. And so, because, if you know, we produce most babies, so who's buying up all the formula that keeps these formula companies having money? And the last thing is, if you have to have someone else tell you, that means, like, either your, you know, your mom didn't do it, or your mom's not present, or you don't have that connection, which is really sad, because that's one of those bonding moments, you know, that happens between the women and between the baby and stuff. But thank you very much for listening.
Absolutely. I can, I can, as I said, this year, it's had an impact on me. I've spent a lot more time around a first time black mom, and she is breastfeeding, and it's been very helpful for her newborn. He weighed in, I think, at like 20 pounds at 2 months. Like, he's ready to start driving. He's doing great breastfeeding. And the same thing with being pressured, and she had a lot of the same concerns, being only having access to a lot of either white women or white doctors, white medical professionals, to give a lot of suggestions, and having, you know, discomfort about that, as she and any other logical thinking black person should. And then also she even shared being pressured, having people say, well, you know, since you are fortunate enough to be manufacturing adequate or enough in terms of quantity breast milk for your child, because some people, they don't, that can be a problem where the mom isn't producing enough milk for the child, but that hasn't been an issue. And she said, well, hey, people were saying, why don't you donate some of your milk? You're making so much. Why don't you give some away? There are moms out there breastfeeding who don't have enough milk for their child. And she was saying that she didn't want to do it, you know, not even getting into a whole lot. Just, oh, I don't think about it, or, you know, I'm just not that interested. And it was like, what? What do you mean you don't want to do it? You better get out there and do it. What's wrong? You're just being bullied. Like, dang, like, can I just control myself and my breast and my breast milk for my child without being badgered and bullied to give that to a white person? It is a myriad of assaults on new moms, pregnant moms. It is, the attack begins very, very early against black people. Other folks that we haven't heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. First, just had a good experience at the gun range. I noticed it's a lot more non-white black instructors that are there, and they're very courteous and willing to give black people good tips on safety and also accuracy, of course, with at the gun range. Very professional. I like the idea that they are working for the county as opposed to a private business. That's probably why there's a lot of black people who are working in that capacity. Moving on, the interview with the black male over the NOI being a quote unquote hate group. I thought the non-white, it sounded like a black male anyway. I think the non-white black male did a pretty good job of effectively diverting the racism that was coming from this white female, and I see it a lot for the most part, mainly on networks like Fox, where this planned propaganda and is placed into questions to kind of like with the idea to make the person they're interviewing, especially when it's about race, stumble. He didn't stumble at all. And he very strategically gave accurate answers. I did notice that when the question came to about quote unquote the white people who call themselves Jews, he did stumble just a little bit, and nothing against him, anything, because he probably is in the very business that what she was talking about. And I can see where a person would be reluctant, and especially if it's on the airways at the same time. Those particular white people are very vindictive, And they are given more license to be vindictive than any other whites, just about, in a lot of cases. Moving on, the interview with the white female preacher. I missed it, but I listened to it. I messaged you about it. But very good technique. By everybody into the white female, which is not unusual, came on the program, obviously to me, with the idea of mine of being accolated for being showing some honesty about racism, white supremacy, and she thought that she was going to be quite successful, but she was confronted by a lot of non-white people who are less confused and can think deeper into what she was putting out, which was, you know, kind of like elementary level type of statement she was making and that sort of thing, just looking for a praise. And she wasn't getting it. I think I even heard Miss Justice. I could be wrong, but it sounded like her voice a couple of times there. Last but not least, I continually talking to the young people that I deal with about expanding their interests besides football. Use your talent, your athletic talent, to finance your way through college, and be broad-minded on things that of interest that is going to allow you to be compensated and to be able to take care of yourself and be prepared to take care of other people. And this is the window where that opportunity presents itself. So far we're in like week two, and we've had University of Vanderbilt, Miami. We actually have two young people who are committed to University of Miami already. Michigan State's been out there, Florida, North Carolina, FIU, FAU, Florida Atlantic. That's Florida Atlantic University and Florida International University. The largest institution in the state of Florida, which is University of Central Florida. They're coming. It's 2 and 3 coming every day. That's basically the benefits of being a state champion. And if you state champion in the state of Florida, you basically are kind of like the best in the world on the teenage level as far as football is concerned. And that's all I have to say. And all these people I'm talking about are non-white black males. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Congrats. Congrats to the young scholar athletes. Other folks that we have with us that we have not heard from at all. If you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. This is Ken Steele, and I am currently in Orange County, California. And I guess this week I wanted to make mention of there has been a number of suspected racist females in the news that are, I guess, being accused of what they call in the media cultural appropriation. And I guess one of the bigger stories surrounding this phenomenon featured a character by the name of Miley Cyrus. Miley Cyrus, she recently came out to, signal a change that is occurring in her image and her career. In a departure from the, I guess, what she's calling hip-hop inspired antics that she carried on during her Bangers tour, she basically announced that she was tired of hip-hop music, and she accused rap music of being too misogynistic, and it was too sexual, and she made mention of lyrics that were very explicit, referring to commands being given to, I guess, service various parts of the human anatomy. And it's funny that she mentions this because during the Bangers tour, much of her shtick was literally to be posing with inflated penises. And that was, I guess, a huge part of her tour. She was, I guess, got a lot of notoriety because she championed the whole twerking trend that occurred amongst suspected racist females in the past few years. She was basically the poster child for this sort of behavior. And if you fast forward, now she has changed her hairstyle, and she is resoundingly denouncing rap music. Now, the backlash from this came, and in the last 24 hours, I believe she released a statement walking back her denouncement of rap music. But, you know, the signal is already out. In that interview, she also indicated that she wanted to work with Donald Trump supporters, which makes me suspect, if you piece together the language that she used throughout the interview and that, I guess, and that message that she sent out for unity with Donald Trump voters was, it signals to me that she might be gearing up for a later run for political office. And the basis of her political campaign may be devoted to demonizing Black people and their sexuality, and our sexuality, rather. Black women for being promiscuous and, you know, inspiring her to twerk, and Black males for, you know, being aggressively sexual and, you know, making all of these comments that she referred to about commands being issued in a sexual context. So there's that issue. And then on the right as that was occurring, an Instagram personality by the name of Yes Jules was recently taken off of two different Canadian festivals for posting up a picture of a hoodie that said N-words lie a lot. And it was the form of the N-word that ends with the A. So I guess it was seen as in her circles or in, I guess, with the people that she's involved with as okay. Or rather, she posted an image asking if it was okay to post. And the backlash was notable. She was taken off the roster of two different festivals, and then she released a statement on Snapchat where she was faking crying.
And that is 5 minutes. We will pause it right there. I'm sure we'll have additional time, Mr. Steele, if you want to finish up your commentary, just trying to make sure we get everybody in. I do want to make sure I remind folks, because I know folks have two areas of people activity that are very popular. One of them is Area 8, sex. The other is entertainment. And neither one of those are subjects we're supposed to be covering for the compensatory call-in. I hadn't prompted about that in a minute because people have, I think, heard. But no Area 8 because people just, everybody gets excited to tell us what brand new television shows they've seen and what brand new movies they've seen. And we just end up spending the whole program talking about TV. Are there other folks that we have not heard from at all? Anybody that we missed completely have a hand up, have commentary? Feel free.
Can I be heard?
I heard both of you. We'll get Thomas in New York first.
Thank you very much, Gus. Thomas from New York. I just had a couple of things I wanted to say. One was related to the breastfeeding. I know that here in this area of the world, New York, New Jersey, they do make the mother breastfeed one time before they're able to leave the hospital with the baby. Well, before they give the baby formula or anything, they make them have to breastfeed. And from what I've seen is they make it a pretty traumatic experience, so that I think that's they're encouraging breastfeeding, but the way they present it, I believe it turns the women off from doing it. And then, of course, they hand you the formula they have already made in the hospital, and that's usually the formula you go home using unless your kid gets sick off of it. So I think that they have a way of making that experience so traumatic that the mothers don't go back to it. Also, about what the firefighters talking about, I was watching ESPN, the combine, the football combine. I just was too lazy to get up and change the channel, so it came on and I was watching it. And I felt, you remember that book we read, The Half Has Not Been Told, where they had a passage in that book where they had a plantation where all the slaves grew to 5'10" and were perfect for picking, I think it was tobacco. And that's the feeling I got watching that NFL combine. I know it's great for the young athletes, the young scholars, if they could get a free tuition and everything and go to college, that's great. But just the way they were measuring their arms and their hands, and I mean, they measured everything on TV, but, you know, their penises, I mean, it seemed like. And making them jump, how high they could jump, how far they could jump. I mean, it just gave me a real plantation feel to the whole thing. I did hear one of the clips where I was traveling, so forgive me. I had to, you know, get to work on time, and the Saturday schedule for the trains is crazy. But one of the clips, which I think they were talking about hate groups, I believe. But I just wanted to say that Reuters reported that Trump has taken the KKK off the hate group list. This is around February. However, now we have MS-13 being put on there. And if they're going to crack down on gangs like MS-13, you can pretty much be sure that they're going to tackle the urban terrorists, which are the Bloods and Crips, the Vice Lords and Disciples. So I expect that this new legislation, this new executive order is going to be bad for black people. Two observations I made. One was Trump made a comment about Andrew Jackson. And I'm saying that if the Civil War, if he was the president during the Civil War, it would have never happened. And it's what a lot of the black people on TV to defend this point, which I hate. And I just wanted to say, you know, they defended it, but all they had to say to me was Andrew Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party, had 200-plus slaves. I think that would have ended all the conversations they were having, whether he was a racist, whether he changed his mind about slavery later. I mean, they went in all different directions with it. And lastly, Hillary this week did an interview, and she was asked about losing the election. Was it due to her losing the votes of the white women? And I was waiting to hear her answer on that one, because that would be my first question for her. And boy, did she obfuscate away from that. She went into, as we would say, buckets of words. She started talking about women having equal pay and women's rights in other countries, but she did not specifically answer that question. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
The other male caller who spoke up simultaneously with Thomas in New York, did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. I'm calling in a little late because I'm in a doing work and a musical gig, and I'm taking a break right now. But an interesting thing with this music, there's a white singer in the group. And several black band members. One of the black singers walked in front of the lead white singer and got fired today, he got criticized so much that he quit, but it was almost as if he had gotten fired, you know, for walking in front of the white female while she was singing the lead role, which was really petty and interesting. But what I was wanting to say is that there's a lot of backpackers, a lot of white backpackers in my neighborhood. It's a black neighborhood that I live in. And there's these men, white males, in their 30s and in their 40s. And they're athletic. They look like they go to the woods and are able to survive in the woods. They have that type. And they wear military fatigue. And they're, like I said, they're backpacking in the West End, in the black neighborhood. And I'm thinking that these are some of the men that may be contributing to the murders, because they'd be out at night. They're out at night, and they're out in the day too. But, you know, if you live in the neighborhood, there's not really a reason for you to have a big backpack, and oftentimes military-grade backpacks. And so I've seen that, and I'm staying cautious about it. I went ahead and purchased a gun, or actually a few guns, so that I can protect myself. And I spoke to the black people on my most of the people on my block are black people. All the homeowners on my block are black people. I spoke to a few of the males my age, and, you know, it's just telling them we have to keep this block secure and make sure that there's no murders on this particular block. And, you know, so we're trying to get order, but it's really difficult. And we're trying to, I've spoken to them about racism, just that means white people are the problem. They've invaded America. They've invaded everywhere, and they're still here, and they're still killing us. And we have to protect ourselves from that. And so a number of us are going to the gun range next week, to make sure that we're ready for anything that could happen. One observation that I had was, because the people who classify as white, because they're albinos and the sun kills them, perhaps we can figure out how to really harness the power of the sun, because the sun rays, it kills them. And one thing I saw was I set a bonfire at one of my family functions. We did a bonfire, and there was white people there for whatever reason. They weren't even part of the family. They were just there in the function. But once I got the heat up to a certain level, the white people disappeared. They left. And I know if somehow we can figure out how to heat up the atmosphere or do something in relation to them being albinos and susceptible to sunlight, we may be able to figure out something to really solve this problem very quickly. And thank you.
Last hour of the program, actually less than an hour left, but Last portion, folks have commentary that they would like to share. Do not wait until the last minute of the program. Go ahead and get your hand up. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. If you have commentary you would like to share, press *61 to get your hand up. But do not wait till the last minute. If you have commentary you would like to share, the code again, 564-943-#. Is there anyone that we missed, anyone who has a hand up that we have not heard from at all who does have a hand up?
Good evening to everyone.
Greetings.
Thanks, Gus. I'd like to just share, get a chance to hear all the clips tonight, but I just want to make a general comment. I believe it was the caller, Emmy, that made this observation, and she makes a lot of great, great observations, along with many of the other callers. But I just wanted to stress, like, it's really not surprising to me at all that, that white people, they can come up with all these, you know, scientific theories, these theories that have become widely accepted, you know, throughout the world. You know, they've figured out ways to explain, you know, they have the theory of evolution, you know, Darwinism. They have these widely accepted theories about how the universe was created, you know, behavior theories, scientific theories. White people have all these resources. They have the leading scientists, researchers, scholars, doctors, you know, lawmakers, lawyers. They can come to all these, you know, conclusions, or they can explain something. But as soon as you, you know, talk about racism, white supremacy, that's when they all of a sudden become, you know, confused, or they come, you know, verbose. They start saying a lot of words that have really no meaning. And I'm referring to, I mean, which many, many, many of your white guests have done that. The overwhelming majority have done that. But I was just talking in particular about the South African, professor that you had on this past week or whatever. It was just like, you know, that she was really talking a lot. It's like, why you guys cannot come up with a logical conclusion? I mean, white people have... they feel like they have made all these great inventions. You ask some of them, they're the reason that the world is here. Like, that's the reason that we all exist. They, you know, so-called saved the black people from being savages in Africa or something, and, you know, brought us to, you know, civilization. But when it comes to racism, they just can't get it. They just don't, you know, we're confused. We just don't understand it. Also, and the fact that the, you know, again, they always, a lot of them say, oh, they can't speak for all white people. And again, they're just being deceitful. You know, again, no one is asking you to speak for all white people. We're just asking you to come to some type of, what's your assessment? What's your conclusion? What conclusion can you come to? And they just can't come to it. The breastfeeding segment is, I think, very important as well. I think, again, we've discussed this on the cows. It's been discussed many times as far as what white people, whatever they like, whatever they encourage, whatever they, you know, put out there, whatever they make widely available, you know, to especially non-white people, is probably something you want to, you know, stay away from, you want to avoid. So it's just some of the things I just wrote down. So some of the things that are widely available that are encouraged by white people is now, you know, cannabis, illicit drugs, definitely alcohol, playing sports, celebrating, and forgiveness. Those are some of the things that are just really, really encouraged by white people. And some of the things that are discouraged or by white people, especially for non-white people, is breastfeeding, asking questions, reading, you know, coming to logical conclusions, and being serious. Those things aren't encouraged by white people for non-white people. And lastly, a lot of young people and even older people as well, they always speak about racism in the context of white people liking us. Like, oh, white people, this white person likes us, so they can't be a racist. Or this person, white person doesn't like us, so, sorry, this white person does not like us, so they must be a racist. But it is not at all about liking us. It's really, it's just kind of like I figure it to their relationship with dogs. White people generally like their dogs, but they want to dominate their dogs. Their dogs are there to be dominated, to be controlled. So, but if that dog presented some type of, I guess if they presented some type of, I don't know, conflict between them, or some they were competing against them, then they probably wouldn't like their dog. But anyway, that's all I have. Thanks.
Appreciate that. There are other folks that we missed completely, other people who have a hand up that we have not heard from at all.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. This is Jay out of New York. Just giving a quick call. Thanks for the clips, Gus. This is where I kind of catch my week in review. Just for my mental sanity, I know Dr. Welzing mentions that we should always kind of read the papers and kind of stay up to date. But I do feel like there's this kind of psychological trauma that the news is actually pushing on our people, especially visually. So I try to do a lot for my kind of mental sanity and stay away from looking and even sometimes reading a lot of the things that are happening to the non-white males and females out there physically. So these news clips are definitely helpful for me at the end of the week. One of the things that I wanted to touch on is the architect segment. I've been doing a lot of hiring for like Fortune 500 companies over the last 15 years in the highly technical field. And I think Gus had mentioned his friend that's in the architect world. It's interesting now, and I think Claude Anderson spoke about this, about how non-whites, especially blacks, with the diversity clause that was put out there years ago, there was this melding pot of people that kind of fit into that. And what I'm seeing now in the highly technical areas is that black individuals, quote-unquote individuals, that are not coming from India or Asia or these different classified areas are no longer being kind of like selected to go into the positions. They go to school, they pay for schooling, but when it comes time for the hiring decisions, they're not being picked. So the groups that I used to work with, like NSBE, NABA, and all the other groups that used to hire specialized individual blacks to go into these areas for positions, they're not getting those positions anymore. So I would definitely kind of ask individuals that are in college looking to go into specialized fields like engineering, IT, architecture, to start looking at pathways that can possibly end with fruitful positions, because as everyone knows, going into those areas are very costly as well on the academic side. And I would just hate to see more non-white people going into these fields and then graduate, and then they're getting positions, you know, at a cash register at like a retail chain because they're unable to get jobs in the field. And while hiring, they would only select one. So I would go out to these NSBE job fairs, these IT job fairs, and I would come back with a host of resumes, and I would have to filter to just pick one person for the department because that met the quota. So, and there's a lot of the three T's that go on, the terrorism, the just a lot of things that happen to those selected individuals within those environments. So just wanted to touch on that real quick. The breastfeeding, totally agree with what everybody else said. Gus, as you mentioned, a lot of the photos that I see of the non-white slaves from the plantation days, where they would be breastfeeding the white children, kind of reminds me of that story that you mentioned, Gus, about how they're pushing and forcing individuals. Thankfully, both my offspring were breastfed by their attempted mother. And it took a lot of research on our own, also a lot of encouragement from me, doing a lot of duties while she did that, et cetera, et cetera. And then the last thing is the pig farms. I wanted to talk about that and just the tackiness. And I think about it from the perspective of if the individuals, and I think Emmy spoke about it, where they're in the houses and they're unable to come outside. And if you're heavily melanated, you need sun to kind of activate, generate vitamin D to kind of help your immune system and just do things to kind of help you from getting ill. I think them trying to cordon people from going outside then pushes individuals, if they're getting sick from these toxic fumes, to be hospitalized. And then again, we're in the system. But again, it's just a continual cycle that they're continuing to perpetuate. And just to update real quickly, I mentioned that my cousin who had the 26-hour operation 2 months ago that was hospitalized last week that I was with her, she unfortunately passed away at 1:45 this morning. She transitioned. Just wanted to give an update. But thanks to everyone. This program definitely helps me with the mental pain that goes on a day in, day out. Thanks all.
Our condolences to you and your family. For your loss. That's medical apartheid has been mentioned repeatedly throughout this program. That's one of my top five favorite books. That is the plan. And I think even some of our guests have said, you know, the incidents, the police terrorism, that does get a lot of attention, as it should. But the typical ways that racists go to work, other ways that they go to work on us, things that they do to totally destroy our health, a lot of times that does not get very much attention, and you just end up with exactly what you just described, someone passing away prematurely, and racists are to blame. Of course, nothing will happen, and we just move on. That happens every day with just racism, white supremacy in a myriad of ways, attacks the health of black people, the breastfeeding, the pollution, Flint, the water system, just the stress of racism, just a myriad of ways. Our health is under constant attack. That is the result. Do we have other folks that we've missed completely that we've not heard from at all who had a hand up?
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Number one from the audio segment, I remember I think they were talking about a type of lynching that was done in the southern part of the so-called USA. And I remember, I guess that was the interviewer said that I guess, you know, the type of white people that did the lynching, you know, they weren't, I think he said uneducated rednecks. So I guess since this, I'm not sure if this occurred, I guess sometime within the past couple of decades or maybe a little more recent, but it's still, they like to try to say that, you know, racism is just something that a few people do, I guess, or if there's white people that are, you know, so-called educated, but apparently the guy, I guess, that wrote this book said that they were, I guess, attorneys or lawyers or something, and they knew how to manipulate the white supremacist dominated legal system. So that was very profound that he was, I guess that was a white person himself. He was able to point that out. The next thing was, Gus, I don't know if you've seen this video, but it was a black male student at, I think it's Ben Franklin High School in Louisiana. And it's like a short clip, like 2.5 minutes. of him like getting in an argument with his teacher about, you know, the word nigga or nigger, and I guess, you know, he was operating under his own victimization, and I think the white teacher was trying to take advantage of that, and you can just see like the white students, you know, starting to laugh and giggle at him while he was becoming very emotional. It was at a point where he even like knocked over the desk, you know, while the white guy said nigger in response to him saying, well, you know, you can't say nigger, and you know, you're white, I'm black, you know, just one of those type of arguments. And you know, the black male was apparently, you know, a young teenager, and I guess like in another clip that I seen, the students was just saying that they had a sit-in or something like that after that period of class. And as far as I can think of, that's all that I really have for now. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
For sure. That video is on my Facebook page. Someone did post it. Folks can check it out. Yet another reminder of why it is supremely important, if you have offspring, or again, if you just got nieces, cousins, whatever, young neighbors that are younger black children, you know, if they listen to you, you spend time with them, you know, take a few moments to just try to do what you can to share helpful information so that we can have better responses if we end up in situations like that. Very, very important, talking to children honestly about white supremacy and things that they can and should expect. Other folks that we've missed completely, anybody else who has a hand up, who has commentary, feel free. Oh, did we get everybody? I think we might have nabbed everybody. So everybody that has a hand up who had commentary has spoken. We didn't miss anyone who has a hand up that we somehow muted you or didn't get your commentary. We didn't miss anybody. Grand, grand. I think I have nabbed all the hands. So if you dialed in, have a hand up, I think we got you. If you have commentary you want to get in before the program ends, you have about 30 minutes. So do not wait till the last minute if you think you have a question or something that you want to share before we get ready to conclude things. Did folks have an additional comment that they wanted to make sure they got in?
Hello.
I heard several folks. We'll start with the females. The female caller 7656. Was that you? Did you have commentary?
Hello. Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my question again. Well, I have a question. This is a general question, of course, not just for you. Have you been discouraged not to live near black people? I say this because I live in an area that, well, the area I live in now, in this particular city, white people, I think a lot of white people live in this area. It seems to be a decent area. And I was telling a black person that I was thinking about buying a house because, wow, this is nice, it's an apartment. And I was like, oh, and he was like, definitely live on the north side, which is where I live now. Not on the south side, not on the west side, not the north side. And I know that more white people live in this area. I think this, based on what I've been doing, my home searches, this is the most expensive zip code in the city. And I just wonder if you're a person who's seen as a professional person or something, have you been discouraged not to live with black people? Because I like black people personally. I like to live near black people. And I just want to know if other black people or other people, well, I should say other black people, because of course white people will, have discouraged you from living around other black people, although, even because, you know, they might not live in the best areas.
How interesting. Any of the folks listening in, black people been discouraged from living around other black people? I think you did specify, quote-unquote, professionals. If you're a black person, I guess if you have a better job white people have allowed you to have or have given you a few more nickels on your paycheck, has anyone been discouraged from living around other black people?
May I have you heard?
Student for Justice, you want to go first?
Okay, thank you, Gus. That's an interesting comment that you made, because I think that I am experiencing the opposite. where I live when I initially moved to the location I am. It was, I guess, probably about 90% black, and I loved it. And then as time passed, within the last year, it is starting to be gentrified with white people moving into the area, walking their dogs, jogging, the kids are out playing. And I had mentioned to some of my neighbors that I was not at all, some of my black neighbors, that I was not at all happy with what was occurring in the community. And the feedback that I got was so hostile because they felt that with the whites moving in, it was an upgrade to the community. And I just did not understand that. So in order to minimize conflict, I minimized contact.
Student for Justice, was anybody else going to respond to that question about being discouraged from black people being discouraged from living around other black people? I think I heard Mr. Steele and Thomas in New York. Were you going to give a response, Mr. Steele?
Yeah, just to this point, on my home searches as a black professional, I'm often told explicitly, don't live in sketchy areas. I'm told explicitly, don't live in sketchy areas, or don't live in the ghetto. Or if I am using some sort of guide or a realtor or a real estate agent, they won't even show me any homes available in neighborhoods or areas that have black populations. It just doesn't even come up. And I think just by the way that you were describing the areas of town that that you're advised not to live in, I suspect you might be in Chicago. And yeah, I was told explicitly in that market that any of the West Side, the South Side, those were specifically no-go zones. And this was by realtors and other professionals that I worked with. So, there's a definite concerted effort to discourage living amongst other black people.
Thank you. I just want to say I live in Macon, Georgia. I don't live in Chicago. This is in Macon, Georgia. Let me be clear.
Okay.
Well, it's happening all across the country. So whatever city and state you live in, you'll probably get that same sentiment that you're experiencing.
Thomas in New York, were you going to respond to that question?
Yeah, I do want to respond to that. Living in Harlem, there's serious gentrification that's taken place over the last 15 years since I lived here. And I've gotten both responses, one to the Student of Justice, where people are saying, oh, this is going to be an upgrade to the neighborhood, and we're going to get more stores and more things. And then I get the other response where there's a lot of blacks who are very hostile towards the whites and feel like, you know, they're stealing, you know, their territory, and they speak up against it. And I also want to say that here in Jersey City, the same thing is happening. It's gentrification, but it's happening differently. It's not blacks being removed for whites, it's blacks being removed for Latinos. And it's more of a hostile feeling when it's someone other than white people. Like, it's almost like, you know, white people moving in, that's good, but other people moving in is bad. So I take both sides on that argument, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Also wanted to add in real quickly, I guess with this quote-unquote climbing the ladder in the professional area, one thing that I've experienced as you climb this, you know, this fictitious ladder, the conversations for the less codified individuals, conversations that happen in the office about where you live, you know, the sports and activities that your children are playing on, things of that nature. So I think that all plays into the real estate. Also, even in the recruitment, there are times when individuals are looking at your address. And if you're living on the side that's quote unquote the non-white side of town, they actually sometimes take that into account in reference to, you know, providing a position or an opportunity to you. So I think when they're mentioning that, you know, in terms of better for a professional, sometimes all those factors also play into it.
Always an excuse to keep the niggers from getting a job. they make it so that you cannot live next to white people and then penalize you for living with the other niggers. Amazing. Was there another female caller who was going to speak up who had something to share as well?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to also mention quickly, it's not so much about I was watching a little bit of television, but it's not like, you know, trying to get people to watch television. It was just actually, it was something that Wanda Sykes had said when she was on The View, and I don't ever watch The View, but I was just looking through the channels, and it just made me kind of feel like she did have like some black self-respect, because she was, for whatever reason, they were speaking a little bit about racism, but of course nothing substantive. And she had mentioned the fact that the issue with Mitch McConnell and how he was, his campaign to make sure that President Obama didn't achieve anything. And the white woman on there, who I'm assuming she classifies herself as Jewish, she was saying, well, you know, it's a political thing. And Wanda Sykes, she had responded that, oh, no, it's, you can't say it's political when President Obama didn't even basically set up his political platform. And I just thought that that was just another way that whites, they, you know, especially white women, they like to change it from being, of course, you know, racism to classism to politics to sexism, whatever. So I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great point. Yeah, white people are great at that. And The View, I don't watch The View at all, but I have seen enough clips and people have pasted enough things on my Facebook page. I think they bring up racism a lot. It just ends up becoming racial theater and something where they can get across white supremacist views or ridicule a black person. It's just not going to be accurate information. But, oh, yeah, they make that one of their favorite topics on the View. So I've been told, or so from the clips I've seen. To the caller in Florida who had mentioned the book before, talking about the Who Lynched Willie Earle. This happened in South Carolina, I believe in the 40s. This is not even like ancient history. This is one of those that the perpetrators could still be alive, conceivably, because this is not ancient history. But I also thought that that was great in that segment, the suspected racist author, where they were making the point that the lynchers in this incident, they give that common bit of rhetoric, like, oh, yeah, the racists, they're just, you know, ignorant hillbillies. They got one tooth and, you know, all of them together spent 5 days in elementary school. And, you know, we just need to get them some training, get them a few Tim Wise pamphlets and we'll have this problem taken care of. He said, no, that is not the case at all. These folks are very well educated, which is the case consistently. If you look at a lot of these lynchings, that you had the most intelligent, the most powerful white people frequently involved in some aspect, whether they came out and actually did the cutting and did the hanging of the rope and the whole, all of that process, or whether they got involved later in making sure that nobody was prosecuted, or whether they hopped in way later to make sure that, okay, in the courtroom and everything, and nobody's going to go to jail, we get all this tossed out, whatever capacity, that's consistently what you're going to find. But I appreciated them making that point unambiguously, because that lie gets repeated a lot. A lot of victims of racism have been duped on that one, to think that white people, say it all the time, white people are ignorant. Racists are just stupid and ignorant, and we just need to give them a little learning. Other folks, did we miss anybody have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
I just wanted to say, is there such thing as a black professional neighborhood? Anytime I see an area, the black people with money, they start to move to, white people eventually move out. And that area within 25 years becomes just an extension of the ghetto. And I just wanted to know if anyone's area, is there a such thing as a black professional neighborhood?
I lived in a neighborhood in Chicago called the South Loop. In the particular area that I was in, I saw a number of black professionals frequenting all of the businesses, the banks, and the school that I lived across the street from seemed to have a healthy majority of black children, and all of the people that were picking up these children at the end of the day, they all seemed to be working black professionals. And my neighbors all seemed to be professionals in some capacity or another.
Can I think I be that, heard?
Yes, ma'am. I was just going to say really quick. I think the D.C. area, Virginia, because so many black people have government jobs around Washington, D.C., I think they have areas in Northern Virginia, parts of Maryland, where you have black people who, quote unquote, professional. I think there are areas in Atlanta, in and around the greater Atlanta area, where they have, quote unquote, black professional areas, where it's black people that obviously have pretty hefty bank accounts, whatever that means, given the system. And I'm also even reminded of Katrina, New Orleans, Louisiana. They had, past tense, they had black professional areas. Katrina botched a lot of that, and the subsequent levee failure and racism, white supremacy. Gary Rivlin talks about quite a bit of that in Katrina after the flood that we discussed, that a lot of the black people who were in that quote-unquote professional class, that they got hit very hard after Katrina and had a lot of difficulties being able to get their property back and compensation, even though they had great jobs and had great money. And I just, you know, put that in again. That reminder is important. Even if you are a professional, you have a great house, have great money, racists have shown that they can decimate that in about 5 minutes, with or without the hurricane. Emmy, did you have commentary?
I did. I am not like an accountant or a dentist or anything like that, so I don't know when we say professional what we're really talking about. But before I went back to school, I did have, like, I was full-time employed with a salary that I could afford to be independent, and I lived in D.C., and I lived intentionally in Southeast. Don't listen to everything you heard about Southeast or Northeast, for that matter, but I did. I lived, like, in what would be probably considered one of the bad areas. But and I did that intentionally. When I was in school the first time, I remember saying to some of my so-called conscious colleagues that we should all buy a house. This was in Richmond, Virginia, buy a house in a so-called black area that would be considered like a ghetto. And I felt that it was more important for us to live there and be and model behavior and just be like, not even like go doing anything serious, knocking on doors or anything, but just be there. And that a lot of good things can come from that. But they didn't want to do it, so it didn't happen. But then I did it on my own, and it did, like it worked, but then I had to leave because I had other things to do. But it wasn't, but again, I'm not that kind of professional that I think people might be alluding to. I also want to say that that might be some kind of manipulative, like, tactic, because while they'll be telling black people to go live around white people where those white people bought homes and now they can't get the return on their money for their home because that area, there's more people, I, from my very basic understanding, trying to get back into urban areas for jobs and economic purposes, will be trying to convince you to buy a house out there so that this white person can get money to move to the city that you could have lived in. And they'll go be there and be around the black people until they do whatever and racially dislocate those black people. So I think that could just be a ploy. Whereas
you could just live around Black people and be around Black people. But I know, you know, everybody has different things, minimize contact and so forth with Black people. I love being around Black people. It feels good. And I think if we stop even thinking about being around white people like that, then we wouldn't have, like, professional Black neighborhoods. I don't even, that just gives me the creepy crawlies thinking, you know, that professional Black neighborhoods and then ghetto Black neighborhoods. I'm like, what? And Gus is right. In this area, we do. There are a lot of so-called professional Black neighborhoods, but they don't really need to be. Everybody should be living kind of together because we're all Black, like, not because who has what money and stuff. But I know you also want to get a return on your home and all that, but just something to consider. They might be telling you to spend that money so that they can get money and then take the house that you could have bought around all the other Black people. But thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm. Creepy crawlies has for sure got to be a metaphor because I have never seen creepy crawlies. I did want to make sure we got the female caller and
I got both.
Hang on 1 second. I just want to get this in. Female caller, we got you next, and retired firefighter. I just wanted to say, in case it doesn't come back up, that situation with Jordan Edwards, the white officer, Roy Oliver is his name. I played that clip at the beginning. I wasn't even going to play it, where it was talking about his unprofessional conduct. That clip was before he was the murder warrant was issued for his arrest. And he's out on bail now, as I understand it. But when they said his record of unprofessional conduct, where they had to ask an intern to leave because he was using such vulgar language, and he testified in the trial where they got it on the transcript that he said he didn't understand the effing question. Like, wow. The race soldiers that they tell us, this is the best of Texas, down in Texas, where they said, this is the best of Texas. This is New York's finest. This is Texas's finest. Wow. Do you think a Black person would be allowed to keep a job if that's how you conduct yourself when you go in a court of law? You tell an attorney, I didn't understand the effing question. Your language is so crude that they have to ask probably a white woman, but I don't know. They just said that they had to ask an intern to leave. They have to ask someone to leave the room because your speech is that vulgar. Wow. I don't know where they got this guy from. They said he has a military record, but that is your race soldier. I would dig into some of that background information to make sure that that does not just get lost while he's probably about to get his $50,000 from crowdsourcing or whatever for his defense fund and everything else. That should be real publicized. Everything about this person's character, Mr. Ray Oliver, who shot and killed 15-year-old Jordan Edwards. The female caller, please.
Hi, I just want to say thank you so much for the input. I agree with what Amy was saying. I think it's a scam, too, because I think in this area, they just became incorporated where the county and the city are now one, and that happens in other areas. And what it seems to do is depress the values of certain neighborhoods to lower them enough so other people can move in. And I've actually driven around the neighborhood. The other neighborhood that I was been told not to go to before, of course, they told me not to go to. And if everybody in this area mowed the grass, it would look just like every other neighborhood. It didn't look, I mean, maybe I looked, I didn't feel afraid. And I'm like, I could buy this house outright and fix it up and own it. And yay. So I just want people's input. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Retired firefighter.
Yes, I was just going to add on that I grew up in a place that I would think that a lot of non-white black people wouldn't mind being around other non-white black people, primarily because the planning, it was filtered, so to speak, of who would be able to have a house in that particular area. You had to be a veteran, a military veteran, which is not that big of a deal with me, of course, but for what you're talking about is a black male and, of course, a black female was in 99.99% of the households where I grew up at. And in turn, there was a lot of children in each home, to whereas there was always something to do. And I'm talking about of constructive nature also coming up as a child. And within I would say spitting distance, it produced right around me on the same street neighbors, a gynecologist, United Press pilot, police enforcement officials who are trying to be police officers, I'll put it that way, administrators. I'm talking about right and walking distance of me. The area now is being, the non-white people now are being displaced in that area now. Of course, we're not going to be able to hold on to those environments. That's what the system of racism and white supremacy does. It doesn't allow non-white people to have a foundation for hundreds of years or anything like that in one place. They're going to move you, and that's what's happening in that area now. Matter of fact, you interviewed someone who was doing the history of areas. I think it was in Florida, but they definitely was talking about the same. One of the places was this place where I grew up at. You did it about a couple of years ago, I think.
Absolutely. The caller at 5672, did you have a commentary? I don't think we've heard from you at all. 5672.
Hi. Yeah, I want to share with you guys. This is my first time calling. I actually email you guys a lot. What I want to say is that on the Hispanic thing, I'm the probation officer who does background investigations. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm privy to a lot of background information, so people bring their birth certificate in, their naturalization, all that stuff. When people who classify themselves as Hispanic, when you look at their race on the birth certificate, if they're born before like 1980-ish and above, they're classified as Caucasian on those birth certificates. But under ethnicity, it will say Hispanic. So I just wanted to share that little tidbit with you.
What does it say? First-time caller, right on. What does it say for under race on their birth certificate if they're born after 19?
Caucasian.
Oh, okay.
After 1980?
Yes, sir.
They don't have it anymore. They didn't have the race or anything on there.
Wow.
But the ones that I see that are above before 1980s and before, you'll say Caucasian ethnicity, Hispanic.
I see.
And they're
I'm not surprised. How Florida.
So I just wanted to share that with you guys. So because I hear that a lot on workplace racism, and Thomas said something about that today, regentrification and Hispanics coming in. So I just want to throw that out there for you guys.
Is it that they just took race off for everybody on their birth certificate after, I guess, 1980? Yeah.
Correct.
Okay, correct. I got it. I see. And that helps racist man, racist woman, racist child as well. That's a part of that, what they call being colorblind, that we just will not track this anymore. So it'll make it seem like this is, now irrelevant, which is certainly not the case. Last 3 minutes before we conclude, anybody? A quick comment they need to share before we are all done?
Yeah, real quick. I was doing some research on some tactical information, and a concept was introduced to me that I think listeners should explore in preparation for just what's happening in society at large. The concept is called the gray man concept. It's basically a concept that white supremacists have explored while maintaining being a tactical individual in your gear and in your mannerisms, while at the same time appearing to blend into any surrounding that you're in. So this concept is the gray man concept. It's a whole host of behaviors that white supremacists are training themselves in engaging in. And I think that that victims of racism should explore this and many other tactical techniques that are being published currently on YouTube. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Last 2 minutes. Anything folks need to get in before we conclude?
Yeah, I just wanted to, I don't know if this is even feasible, but I always heard, and I think it's very smart that we go to the gun range and learn how to become very gun savvy. However, regardless of how gun savvy we become, we're still outgunned. And I just wondered if anyone knew of or if they thought it would be a good idea to look into trying to find a or create a weapon that is more powerful than a gun, you know, something that would back them off, or is that something that they closed the door on doing completely? Because I never hear that come up, like we're trying to figure out a new weapon, you know, trying to come up with something that can counter the gun. I'm in my line. Thank you guys for the show.
For sure. Anyone need a last comment, or are folks satisfied? I will assume folks are good. We should be here on Tuesday. Dr. Howard Stevenson. He is a professor, black male professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Again, he's written, talked extensively. One of our listeners saw a presentation that he did in Missouri. He was talking about racism, white supremacy. He's written about the importance of talking to black children about white supremacy. So we'll get some of his thoughts on that this coming Tuesday. Pam will be with us on Wednesday. It will be grand to have her back on the program. She gave out appreciation. I'm sure she'll echo this on Tuesday, but she sent out thanks to folks who emailed her to check on her while she's been having a tough time. As I said, she was not feeling very well earlier this year. And then as she was getting better, then she had a death in the family. So it's been a tough start to 2017 for her. And folks did reach out. Cal's listeners reached out to just share their thoughts, prayers. She was appreciative, but she will be with us this coming Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, you have a complaint, if you're looking for people to contact, I know Emmy was one of our listeners who said she was interested, excited, eager to go to the gun range. If there are other black female listeners in her area who would like DMV area, who would like to go to the gun range, some folks have expressed that it can be kind of intimidating because it's probably going to be mostly white people if you go. So it might be better if you can go with a group, at least have 2, 3, 4, 5, how many ever people to go with you so you can feel a bit more confident, have collective black self-respect. Drop an email, and it would help me if you put contact in the subject. So if you put like contact Florida, contact London, contact Toronto, that would be very helpful. When people just have random subjects, it can be very, very difficult to go through and find, you know, people from all over the world and where they're trying to meet people at or what have you. So that is for me. Just put in the subject contact Houston, contact Miami, contact Washington State or whatever it is. That would be helpful, and I'll see if I can forward emails. With that, I will suggest again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I'm not saying don't go out and have fun, enjoy the warm weather. I'm simply saying war is being waged against us, and it is very important to remain cognizant of that at all times and to make sure that your behavior reflects war is being waged against me, and I understand that, and I'm doing as much as I can to minimize the likelihood of myself being harmed. I don't think being out and about, particularly once the sun goes down, I don't think being out and about intoxicated and just running up and down the street, I don't think that is the safest thing to do given these conditions. If you are going to consume alcohol, my recommendation, or any other intoxicants, my recommendation would be to get to one spot and stay there until the next day when you are sober, and then you can hop back in your vehicle or what have you and be about your business. But Dr. Cambon, I think he said it explicitly, you are asking for trouble. You go outside, it's 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, decide this is the time that you want to go for a joyride. Could be lots and lots of unnecessary problems waiting for you. With that, Student for Justice, are you doing the prayer, sir?
Yes, sir. Gus, thank you for this important and necessary work and service that you provide to black people. Creator, black people are in a system of racism, white supremacy. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy, in all areas of people activities, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white survival and the ultimate purpose of to prevent, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator helped black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and to create and to guarantee that no black person is mistreated and to guarantee that no black and the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, thank you for the brilliant Dr. Francis Quest Welsing in my lifetime. Creator helped black people to resolve and remedy the problems of racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately. Be well to all in 2017.
Ashe. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. A victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.